Listening Library presents Where the Red Fern Grows by Wilson Rawls. Read for you by Anthony Heald.
When I left my office that beautiful spring day, I had no idea what was in store for me. To begin with, everything was too perfect for anything unusual to happen. It was one of those days when a man feels good, feels like speaking to his neighbor, is glad to live in a country like ours and proud of his government. You know what I mean, one of those rare days when everything is right and nothing is wrong. I was walking along whistling when I heard the dog fight. At first I paid no attention to it. After all, it wasn't anything to get excited about, just another dog fight in a residential section. As the sound of the fight grew nearer, I could tell there were quite a few dogs mixed up in it. They boiled out of an alley, turned, and headed straight toward me. Not wanting to get bitten or run over, I moved over to the edge of the sidewalk. I could see that all the dogs were fighting one. About 25 feet from me, they caught him, and down he went. I felt sorry for the unfortunate one. I knew if something wasn't done quickly, the sanitation department would have to pick up a dead dog. I was trying to make up my mind to help when I got a surprise. Up out of that snarling, growling, slashing mass reared an old red-boned hound. For a second I saw him. I caught my breath. I couldn't believe what I had seen. Twisting and slashing, he fought his way through the pack and backed up under the low branches of a hedge. Growling and snarling, they formed a half-moon circle around him. A big bird dog, bolder than the others, darted in. The hedge shook as he tangled with the hound. He came out so fast he fell over backwards. I saw that his right ear was split wide open. It was too much for him, and he took off down the street squalling like a scalded cat. A big, ugly cur tried his luck. He didn't get off so easy. He came out with his left shoulder laid open to the bone. He sat down on his rear and let the world know that he had been hurt. By this time, my fighting blood was boiling. It's hard for a man to stand and watch an old hound fight against such odds, especially if that man has memories in his heart like I had in mine. I had seen the time when an old hound like that had given his life so that I might live. Taking off my coat, I waded in. My yelling and scolding didn't have much effect, but the swinging coat did. The dog scattered and left. Down on my knees, I peered back under the hedge. The hound was still mad. He growled at me and showed his teeth. I knew it wasn't his nature to fight a man. In a soft voice, I started talking to him. "Come on, boy," I said. "It's all right. I'm your friend. Come on now." The fighting fire slowly left his eyes. He bowed his head, and his long red tail started thumping the ground. I kept coaxing. On his stomach, an inch at a time, he came to me and laid his head in my hand. I almost cried at what I saw. His coat was dirty and mud-caked. His skin was stretched drum-tight over his bony frame. The knotty joints of his hips and shoulders stood out a good 3 inches from his body. I could tell he was starved. I couldn't figure it out. He didn't belong in town. He was far out of place with the boxers, poodles, bird dogs, and other breeds of town dogs. He belonged in the country. He was a hunting hound. I raised one of his paws, and there I read the story. The pads were worn down, slick as the rind on an apple. I knew he had come a long way, and no doubt had a long way to go. Around his neck was a crude collar. On closer inspection, I saw it had been made from a piece of checkline leather. 2 holes had been punched in each end, and the ends were laced together with baling wire. As I turned the collar with my finger, I saw something else. There, scratched deep in the tough leather, was the name Buddy. I guessed that the crude, scribbly letters had probably been written by a little boy. It's strange indeed how memories can lie dormant in a man's mind for so many years, yet those memories can be awakened and brought forth fresh and new just by something you've seen or something you've heard, or the sight of an old familiar face. What I saw in the warm gray eyes of the friendly old hound brought back wonderful memories. To show my gratitude, I took hold of his collar and said, "Come on, boy, let's go home and get something to eat." He seemed to understand that he had found a friend. He came willingly. I gave him a bath and rubbed all the soreness from his muscles. He drank quarts of warm milk and ate all the meat I had in the house. I hurried down to the store and bought more. He ate until he was satisfied. He slept all that night and most of the next day. Late in the afternoon, he grew restless. I told him I understood, and as soon as it was dark, he could be on his way. I figured he had a much better chance if he left town at night. That evening, little after sundown, I opened the back gate. He walked out, stopped, turned around, and looked at me. He thanked me by wagging his tail. With tears in my eyes, I said, "You're more than welcome, old fellow. In fact, you could have stayed here as long as you wanted to." He whined and licked my hand. I was wondering which way he would go. With one final whimper, he turned and headed east. I couldn't help smiling as I watched him trot down the alley. I noticed the way his hind quarters shifted over to the right, never in line with the front, yet always in perfect rhythm. His long ears flopped up and down, keeping time with the jogging motion of his body. Yes, they were all there, the unmistakable marks of a hunting hound. Where the alley emptied into the street, he stopped and looked back. I waved my hand. As I watched him disappear in the twilight shadows, I whispered these words, "Goodbye, old fellow. Good luck, and good hunting." I didn't have to let him go. I could have kept him in my backyard. But to pen up a dog like that is a sin. It would have broken his heart. The will to live would have slowly left his body. I had no idea where he had come from or where he was going. Perhaps it wasn't too far. Or maybe it was a long, long way. I tried to make myself believe that his home was in the Ozark Mountains, somewhere in Missouri or Oklahoma. It wasn't impossible, even though it was a long way from the Snake River Valley in Idaho. I figured something drastic must have happened in his life, as it is very unusual for a hound to be traveling all alone. Perhaps he had been stolen, or maybe he had been sold for some much-needed money. Whatever it was that had interrupted his life, he was trying to straighten it out. He was going home to the master he loved, and with the help of God he would make it. To him it made no difference how long the road or how rough or rocky. His old red feet would keep jogging along, on and on, mile after mile. There would be no crying or giving up. When his feet grew tired and weary, he would curl up in the weeds and rest. Water from a rain puddle or a mountain stream would quench his thirst and cool his hot, dry throat. Food found along the highway or the offerings from a friendly hand would ease the pangs of hunger. Through the rains, the snows, or the desert heat, he would jog along, never looking back. Some morning he would be found curled up on the front porch. The long journey would be over. He would be home. There would be a lot of tail wagging and a few whimpering cries. His warm, moist tongue would caress the hand of his master. All would be forgiven. Once again, the lights would shine in his dog's world. His heart would be happy. After my friend had disappeared in the darkness, I stood and stared at the empty alley. A strange feeling came over me. At first I thought I was lonely or sad, but I realized that wasn't it at all. The feeling was a wonderful one. Although the old hound had no way of knowing it, he had stirred memories, and what priceless treasures they were. Memories of my boyhood days, an old KC baking powder can, and two little red hounds. Memories of a wonderful love, unselfish devotion, and death in its saddest form. As I turned to enter my yard, I started to lock the gate, and then I thought, no, I'll leave it open. He might come back. I was about halfway to the house when a cool breeze drifted down from the rugged Tetons. It had a bite in it, and goose pimples jumped out on my skin. I stopped at the woodshed and picked up several sticks of wood. I didn't turn on any lights on entering the house. The dark, quiet atmosphere was a perfect setting for the mood I was in. I built a fire in the fireplace and pulled up my favorite rocker. As I sat there in the silence, the fire grew larger. It crackled and popped. Firelight shadows began to shimmer and dance around the room. The warm, comfortable heat felt good. I struck a match to light my pipe. As I did, two beautiful cups gleamed from the mantel. I held the match up so I could get a better look. There they were, sitting side by side. One was large, with long upright handles that stood out like wings on a mourning dove. The highly polished surface gleamed and glistened with a golden sheen. The other was smaller and made of silver. It was neat and trim and sparkled like a white star in the heavens. I got up and took them down. There was a story in those cups, a story that went back more than a half century. As I caressed the smooth surfaces, my mind drifted back through the years, back to my boyhood days. How wonderful the memories were. Piece by piece, the story unfolded. I suppose there's a time in practically every young boy's life when he's affected by that wonderful disease of puppy love. I don't mean the kind a boy has for the pretty little girl that lives down the road. I mean the real kind. The kind that has four small feet and a wiggly tail and sharp little teeth that can gnaw on a boy's finger. The kind a boy can romp and play with, even eat and sleep with. I was 10 years old when I first became infected with this terrible disease. I'm sure no boy in the world had it worse than I did. It's not easy for a young boy to want a dog and not be able to have one. It starts gnawing on his heart and gets all mixed up in his dreams. It gets worse and worse until finally it becomes almost unbearable. If my dog wanting had been that of an ordinary boy, I'm sure my mother and father would have gotten me a puppy. But my wants were different. I didn't want just one dog. I wanted two. And not just any kind of dog. They had to be a special kind and a special breed. I had to have some dogs. I went to my father and had a talk with him. He scratched his head and thought it over. "Well, Billy," he said, "I heard that old man Hatfield's collies is going to have pups. I'm sure I can get one of them for you." He may as well have poured cold water on me. "Papa," I said, "I don't want an old collie dog. I want hounds, coon hounds, and I want two of them." I could tell by the look on his face that he wanted to help me but couldn't. He said, "Billy, those kind of dogs cost money, and that's something we don't have right now. Maybe someday when we can afford it you can have them, but not right now." I didn't give up. After my talk with Papa, I went to Mama. I fared no better there. Right off, she said I was too young to be hunting with hounds. Besides, a hunter needed a gun, and that was one thing I couldn't have, not until I was 21 anyway. I couldn't understand it. There I was, sitting right in the middle of the finest hunting country in the world, and I didn't even have a dog. Our home was in a beautiful valley far back in the rugged Ozarks. The country was new and sparsely settled. The land we lived on was Cherokee land, allotted to my mother because of the Cherokee blood that flowed in her veins. It lay in a strip from the foothills of the mountains to the banks of the Illinois River in northeastern Oklahoma. The land was rich, black, and fertile. Papa said it would grow hair on a cross-cut saw. He was the first man to stick the cold steel point of a turning plow into the virgin soil. Mama had picked the spot for our log house. It nestled at the edge of the foothills in the mouth of a small canyon and was surrounded by a grove of huge red oaks. Behind our house, one could see miles and miles of the mighty Ozarks. In the spring, the aromatic scent of wildflowers, red buds, pawpaws, and dogwoods drifting on the wind currents spread over the valley and around our home. Below our fields, twisting and winding, ran the clear blue waters of the Illinois River. The banks were cool and shady. The rich bottomland near the river was studded with tall sycamores, birches, and box elders. To a 10-year-old country boy, it was the most beautiful place in the whole wide world, and I took advantage of it all. I roamed the hills and the river bottoms. I knew every game trail in the thick canebrakes and every animal track that was pressed in the mud along the riverbanks. The ones that fascinated me the most were the baby-like tracks of a river coon. I'd lie for hours examining them. Before leaving, I'd take a switch and sweep them all away. These I called my trail looks. The next day I'd hurry back, and sure enough, 9 times out of 10, there in the clean-swept ground, I would again find the tracks of a ringtail coon. I knew he had passed over the trail during the night. I could close my eyes and almost see him, humped up and waddling along, fishing under the banks with his delicate little paws for crawfish, frogs, and minnows. I was a hunter from the time I could walk. I caught lizards on the rail fences, rats in the corn crib, and frogs in the little creek that ran through the fields. I was a young Daniel Boone. As the days passed, the dog-wanting disease grew worse. I began to see dogs in my sleep. I went back to my father and mother. It was the same old story. Good hounds cost money, and they just didn't have it. My dog-wanting became so bad I began to lose weight, and my food didn't taste good anymore. Mama noticed this, and she had a talk with Papa. "You're going to have to do something," she said. "I never saw a boy grieve like that. It's not right. Not right at all." "I know," said Papa, "and I feel just as badly as you do, but what can I do? You know we don't have that kind of money."
"I don't care," said Mama. "You've got to do something. I can't stand to see him cry like that.
Besides, he's getting to be a problem. I can't get my work done. He follows me around all day long, begging for hounds.
I offered to get him a dog, said Papa, but he doesn't want just any kind of dog. He wants hounds, and they cost money. Do you know what the Parker boys paid for those two hounds they bought? $75. If I had that much money, I'd buy another mule. I sure do need one.
I had overheard this conversation from another room. At first it made me feel pretty good. At least I was getting to be a problem. Then I didn't feel so good. I knew my mother and father were poor and didn't have any money. I began to feel sorry for them and myself. After thinking it over, I figured out a way to help. Even though it was a great sacrifice, I told Papa I had decided I didn't want two hounds. One would be enough. I saw the hurt in his eyes. It made me feel like someone was squeezing water out of my heart. Papa set me on his lap, and we had a good talk. He told me how hard times were, and that it looked like a man couldn't get a fair price for anything he raised. Some of the farmers had quit farming and were cutting railroad ties so they could feed their families. If things didn't get better, that's what he'd have to do. He said he'd give anything if he could get some good hounds for me, but there didn't seem to be any way he could right then. I went off to bed with my heart all torn up in little pieces and cried myself to sleep. The next day, Papa had to go to the store. Late that evening, I saw him coming back. As fast as I could, I ran to meet him, expecting a sack of candy. Instead, he handed me three small steel traps. If Santa Claus himself had come down out of the mountains, reindeer and all, I would not have been more pleased. I jumped up and down and cried a whole bucket full of tears. I hugged him and told him what a wonderful papa he was. He showed me how to set them by mashing the spring down with my foot and how to work the trigger. I took them to bed with me that night. The next morning, I started trapping around the barn. The first thing I caught was Sammy, our house cat. If this didn't cause a commotion, I didn't intend to catch him. I was trying to catch a rat, but somehow he came nosing around and got in my trap. My sister started bawling and yelling for Mama. She came running, wanting to know what in the world was going on. None of us had to tell her. Sammy told her with his spitting and squalling. He was mad. He couldn't understand what that thing was that was biting his foot, and he was making an awful fuss about it. His tail was as big as a wet corn cob, and every hair on his small body was sticking straight up. He spit and yowled and dared anyone to get close to him. My sisters yelled their fool heads off all the time, saying, "Poor Sammy, poor Sammy." Mama shushed them up and told me to go get the forked stick from under the clothesline. I ran and got it. Mama was the best helper a boy ever had. She put the forked end over Sammy's neck and pinned him to the ground. It was bad enough for the trap to be biting his foot, but to have his neck pinned down that way was too much. He threw a fit. I never heard such a racket in all my life. It wasn't long until everything on the place was all spooked up. The chickens started cackling and flew way up on the hillside. Daisy, our milk cow, all but tore the barn lot up and refused to give any milk that night. Sloppy Ann, our hog, started running in circles, squealing and grunting. Sammy wiggled and twisted. He yowled and spit, but it didn't do him any good. Mama was good and stout. She held him down tight to the ground. I ran in and put my foot on the trap spring, mashed it down, and released his foot. With one loud squall, he scooted under the barn. After it was all over, Mama said, "I don't think you'll have any more trouble with that cat. I think he has learned his lesson." How wrong Mama was. Sammy was one of those nosy kind of cats. He would lie up in the red oak limbs and watch every move I made. I found some slick little trails out in our garden down under some tall hollyhocks. Thinking they were game trails, and not knowing they were Sammy's favorite hunting trails, I set my traps. Sammy couldn't understand what I was doing out there, messing around his hunting territory. He went to investigate. Wasn't long until I had him limping with all 4 feet. Every time Papa saw Sammy lying around in the warm sun with his feet wrapped up in turpentine rags, he would laugh until big tears rolled down his cheeks. Mama had another talk with Papa. She said he was going to have to say something to me, because if I caught that cat one more time, it would drive her out of her mind. Papa told me to be a little more careful where I set my traps. "Papa," I said, "I don't want to catch Sammy, but he's the craziest cat I ever saw. He sees everything I do and just has to go sniffing around." Papa looked over at Sammy. He was lying all sprawled out in the sunshine, with all four paws bandaged and sticking straight up. His long tail was swishing this way and that.
"You see, Papa," I said, "he's watching me right now, just waiting for me to set my traps."
Papa walked off toward the barn. I heard him laughing fit to kill.
It finally got too tough for Sammy. He left home. Oh, he came in once in a while, all long and lean-looking. But he never was the same friendly cat anymore. He was nervous and wouldn't let anyone pet him. He would gobble down his milk and then scoot for the timber. Once I decided to make friends with him because I felt bad about catching him in my traps. I reached out my hand to rub his back. He swelled up like a sitting hen. His eyeballs got all green, and he growled way down deep. He spat at me and drew back his paw like he was going to knock my head off. I decided I'd better leave him alone. In no time at all, I cleaned out the rats. Then something bad happened. I caught one of Mama's prize hens.
I got one of those young man peach tree switchings over that. Papa told me to go down in the cane breaks back of our fields and trap. This opened up all kinds of new wonders. I caught opossums, skunks, rabbits, and squirrels. Papa showed me how to skin my game. In neat little rows, I tacked the hides on the smokehouse wall. I'd stand for hours and admire my magnificent trophies. There was only one thing wrong. I didn't have a big coon skin to add to my collection. I couldn't trap old Mr. Ringtail. He was too smart for me. He'd steal the bait from the traps, spring the triggers, and sometimes even turn them over. Once I found a small stick standing upright in one of my traps. I showed it to Papa. He laughed and said the stick must have fallen from a tree. It made no difference what Papa said. I was firmly convinced that a smart old coon had deliberately poked that stick in my trap. The traps helped my dog wanting considerably, but like a new toy, the newness wore off, and I was right back where I started from. Only this time it was worse, much worse. I had been exposed to the feel of wildlife. I started pestering Mama again. She said, "Oh, no, not that again. I thought you'd be satisfied with the traps." "No, Billy, I don't want to hear any more about hounds." I knew Mama meant what she said. This broke my heart. I decided I'd leave home. I sneaked out a quart jar of peaches, some cold cornbread, and a few onions, and started up the hollow back of our house. I had it all figured out. I'd go away off to some big town, get 100 dogs, and bring them all back with me. I made it all right until I heard a timber wolf howl. This stopped my home leaving. When the hunting season opened that fall, something happened that was almost more than I could stand. I was lying in bed one night trying to figure out a way I could get some dogs when I heard the deep baying of a coon hound. I got up and opened my window. It came again. The deep voice rang loud and clear in the frosty night. Now and then I could hear the hunter whooping to him. The hound hunted all night. He quit when the roosters started crowing at daybreak. The hunter and the hound weren't the only ones awake that night. I stayed up and listened to them until the last tones of the hound's voice died away in the daylight hours. That morning I was determined to have some hounds. I went again to Mama. This time I tried bribery. I told her if she'd get me a hunting dog, I'd save the money I earned from my furs and buy her a new dress and a box full of pretty hats. That time I saw tears in her eyes. It made me feel all empty inside, and I cried a little too. By the time she was through kissing me and talking to me, I was sure I didn't need any dogs at all. I couldn't stand to see Mama cry. The next night I heard the hound again. I tried to cover my head with a pillow to shut out the sound. It was no use. His voice seemed to bore its way through the pillow and ring in my ears. I had to get up and again go to the window. I'm sure if that coon hunter had known that he was slowly killing a 10-year-old boy, he would have put a muzzle on his hound. Sleep was out of the question. Even on nights when I couldn't hear the hound, I couldn't sleep. I was afraid if I did, he would come, and I would miss hearing him. By the time hunting season was over, I was a nervous wreck. My eyes were red and bloodshot. I had lost weight and was as thin as a beanpole. Mama checked me over. She looked at my tongue and turned back one of my eyelids. "If I didn't know better," she said, "I'd swear you weren't sleeping well. Are you?" "Why, Mama," I said, "I go to bed, don't I? What does a boy go to bed for if it isn't to sleep?" By the little wrinkles that bunched up on her forehead, I could tell that Mama wasn't satisfied. Papa came in during one of these inspections. Mama told him she was worried about my health.
"Oh," he said, "there's nothing wrong with him. It's just because he's been cooped up all winter. A boy needs sunshine and exercise. He's almost 11 now, and I'm going to let him help me in the fields this summer. That'll put the muscles back on him."
I thought this was wonderful. I'd finally grown up to be a man. I was going to help Papa with the farm. The dog-wanting disease never did leave me altogether. With the new work I was doing helping Papa, it just kind of burned itself down and left a big sore on my heart. Every time I'd see a coon track down in our fields or along the riverbanks, the old sore would get all fested up and start hurting again. Just when I'd given up all hope of ever owning a good hound, something wonderful happened. The good Lord figured I had hurt enough, and it was time to lend a helping hand. It all started one day while I was hoeing corn down in our field close to the river. Across the river, a party of fishermen had been camped for several days. I heard the old Maxwell car as it snorted and chugged its way out of the bottoms. I knew they were leaving. Throwing down my hoe, I ran down to the river and waded across at a place called the Shannon Ford. I hurried to the campground. It was always a pleasure to prowl where fishermen had camped. I usually could find things, a fish line or a forgotten fish pole. On one occasion, I found a beautiful knife stuck in the bark of a sycamore tree, forgotten by a careless fisherman. But on that day, I found the greatest of treasures, a sportsman's magazine discarded by the campers. It was a real treasure for a country boy. Because of that magazine, my entire life was changed. I sat down on an old sycamore log and started thumbing through the leaves. On the back pages of the magazine, I came to the for sale section. Dogs for sale. Every kind of dog. I read on and on. They had dogs I had never heard of, names I couldn't make out. Far down in the right-hand corner, I found an ad that took my breath away. In small letters, it read, "Registered Red Bone Coon Hound Pups, $25 each." The advertisement was from a kennel in Kentucky. I read it over and over. By the time I had memorized the ad, I was seeing dogs, hearing dogs, and even feeling them. The magazine was forgotten. I was lost in thought. The brain of an 11-year-old boy can dream some fantastic dreams. How wonderful it would be if I could have two of those pups. Every boy in the country but me had a good hound or two. But $50? How could I ever get $50? I knew I couldn't expect help from Mama and Papa. I remembered a passage from the Bible my mother had read to us. God helps those who help themselves. I thought of the words. I mulled them over in my mind. I decided I'd ask God to help me. There, on the banks of the Illinois River, in the cool shade of the tall white sycamores, I asked God to help me get two hound pups. It wasn't much of a prayer, but it did come right from the heart. When I left the campground of the fishermen, it was late. As I walked along, I could feel the hard bulge of the magazine jammed deep in the pocket of my overalls. The beautiful silence that follows the setting sun had settled over the river bottoms. The coolness of the rich black soil felt good to my bare feet. It was the time of day when all furried things come to life. A big swamp rabbit hopped out on the trail, sat on his haunches, stared at me, and then scampered away. A mother gray squirrel ran out on the limb of a bur oak tree. She barked a warning to the four furry balls behind her. They melted from sight in the thick green. A silent gray shadow drifted down from the top of a tall sycamore. There was a squeal and a beating of wings. I heard the tinkle of a bell in the distance ahead. I knew it was Daisy, our milk cow. I'd have to start her on the way home. I took the magazine from my pocket, and again I read the ad. Slowly, a plan began to form. I'd save the money. I could sell stuff to the fishermen. Crawfish, minnows, and fresh vegetables. In berry season, I could sell all the berries I could pick at my grandfather's store. I could trap in the winter. The more I planned, the more real it became. There was the way to get those pups. Save my money. I could almost feel the pups in my hands. I planned the little doghouse and where to put it. Collars I could make myself. Then the thought came, what could I name them? I tried name after name, voicing them out loud. None seemed to fit. Well, there would be plenty of time for names. Right now there was something more important. $50. a fabulous sum, a fortune, far more money than I had ever seen. Somehow, some way, I was determined to have it. I had 23 cents, a dime I had earned running errands for my grandpa, and 13 cents a fisherman had given me for a can of worms. The next morning I went to the trash pile behind the barn. I was looking for a can, my bank. I picked up several, but they didn't seem to be what I wanted. Then I saw it, an old KC baking powder can. It was perfect, long and slender, with a good tight lid. I took it down to the creek and scrubbed it with sand until it was bright and new-looking. I dropped the 23 cents in the can. The coins looked so small, lying there on the shiny bottom, but to me it was a good start. With my finger I tried to measure how full it would be with $50 in it. Next I went to the barn and up in the loft. Far back over the hay and up under the eaves I hid my can. I had a start toward making my dreams come true. 23 cents. I had a good bank, safe from the rats and from the rain and snow. All through that summer I worked like a beaver. In the small creek that wormed its way down through our fields, I caught crawfish with my bare hands. I trapped minnows with an old screen wire trap I made myself, baited with yellow cornbread from my mother's kitchen. These were sold to the fishermen, along with fresh vegetables and roasting ears. I tore my way through the blackberry patches until my hands and feet were scratched raw and red from the thorns. I tramped the hills, seeking out the huckleberry bushes. My grandfather paid me 10 cents a bucket for my berries. Once Grandpa asked me what I did with the money I earned. I told him I was saving it to buy some hunting dogs. I asked him if he would order them for me when I had saved enough. He said he would. I asked him not to say anything to my father. He promised me he wouldn't. I'm sure Grandpa paid little attention to my plans. That winter I trapped harder than ever with the three little traps I owned. Grandpa sold my hides to fur buyers who came to his store all through the fur season. Prices were cheap, 15 cents for a large opossum hide, 25 for a good skunk hide. Little by little, the nickels and dimes added up. The old KC baking powder can grew heavy. I would heft its weight in the palm of my hand. With a straw, I'd measure from the lip of the can to the money. As the months went by, the straws grew shorter and shorter. The next summer, I followed the same routine. "Would you like to buy some crawfish or minnows? Maybe you'd like some fresh vegetables or roasting ears." The fishermen were wonderful, as true sportsmen are. They seemed to sense the urgency in my voice and always bought my wares. However many was the time, I'd find my vegetables left in the abandoned camp. There never was a set price. Anything they offered was good enough for me. A year passed. I was 12. I was over the halfway mark. I had $27.46. My spirits soared. I worked harder. Another year crawled slowly by. And then the great day came. The long, hard grind was over. I had it. My $50. I cried as I counted it over and over. As I set the can back in the shadowy eaves of the barn, it seemed to glow with a radiant whiteness I had never seen before. Perhaps it was all imagination, I don't know. Lying back in the soft hay, I folded my hands behind my head, closed my eyes, and let my mind wander back over the 2 long years. I thought of the fishermen, the blackberry patches, and the huckleberry hills. I thought of the prayer I had said when I asked God to help me get 2 hound pups. I knew he had surely helped, for he had given me the heart, courage, and determination. Early the next morning, with the can jammed deep in the pocket of my overalls, I flew to the store. As I trotted along, I whistled and sang. I felt as big as the tallest mountain in the Ozarks. Arriving at my destination, I saw 2 wagons were tied up at the hitching rack. I knew some farmers had come to the store, so I waited until they left. As I walked in, I saw my grandfather behind the counter. Tugging and pulling, I worked the can out of my pocket and dumped it out in front of him, and looked up. Grandpa was dumbfounded. He tried to say something, but it wouldn't come out. He looked at me, and he looked at the pile of coins. Finally, in a voice much louder than he ordinarily used, he asked, "Where did you get all this?"
"I told you, Grandpa," I said. "I was saving my money so I could buy 2 hound pups, and I did. You said you would order them for me. I got the money, and now I want you to order them."
Grandpa stared at me over his glasses, and then back at the money.
How long have you been saving this?
He asked.
A long time, Grandpa, I said.
How long?
He asked. I told him, 2 years. His mouth flew open, and in a loud voice he said,
2 years!
I nodded my head. The way my grandfather stared at me made me uneasy. I was on needles and pins. Taking his eyes from me, he glanced back at the money. He saw the faded yellow piece of paper sticking out from the coins. He worked it out, asking as he did,
What's this?
I told him it was the ad, telling where to order my dogs. He read it, turned it over, and glanced at the other side. I saw the astonishment leave his eyes, and the friendly old grandfather look come back. I felt much better. Dropping the paper back on the money, he turned, picked up an old turkey feather duster, and started dusting where there was no dust. He kept glancing at me out of the corner of his eye as he walked slowly down to the other end of the store, dusting here and there. He put the duster down, came from behind the counter, and walked up to me. Laying a friendly old work-calloused hand on my head, he changed the conversation altogether, saying,
Son, you need a haircut.
I told him I didn't mind. I didn't like my hair short. Flies and mosquitoes bothered me. He glanced down at my bare feet and asked,
How come your feet are cut and scratched like that?
I told him it was pretty tough picking blackberries barefoot. He nodded his head. It was too much for my grandfather. He turned and walked away. I saw the glasses come off and the old red handkerchief come out. I heard the good excuse of blowing his nose. He stood for several seconds with his back toward me. And when he turned around, I noticed his eyes were moist. In a quavering voice, he said,
Well, son, it's your money. You worked for it, and you worked hard. You got it honestly, and you want some dogs. We're going to get those dogs. Be damned! Be damned!
That was as near as I ever came to hearing my grandfather curse, if you can call it cursing. He walked over and picked up the ad again, asking,
Is this 2 years old, too?
I nodded.
Well, he said, the first thing we have to do is write this outfit. There may not even be a place like this in Kentucky anymore. After all, a lot of things can happen in 2 years.
Seeing that I was worried, he said,
Now, you go on home. I'll write to these kennels, and I'll let you know when I get an answer. If we can't get the dogs there, we can get them someplace else. And I don't think, if I were you, I'd let my pa know anything about this right now. I happen to know he wants to buy that red mule from old man Potter.
I told him I wouldn't, and turned to leave the store. As I reached the door, my grandfather said in a loud voice,
Say, it's been a long time since you've had any candy, hasn't it?
I nodded my head. He asked,
How long?
I told him,
A long time.
Well, he said, we have to do something about that.
Walking over behind the counter, he reached out and got a sack. I noticed it wasn't one of the nickel sacks, it was one of the quarter kind. My eyes never left my grandfather's hand. Time after time, it dipped in and out of the candy counter. Peppermint sticks, jawbreakers, whorehound, and gumdrops. The sack bulged, so did my eyes. Handing the sack to me, he said,
Here. First big coon you catch with those dogs, you can pay me back.
I told him I would. On my way home, with a jawbreaker in one side of my mouth and a piece of whorehound in the other, I skipped and hopped, making half an effort to try to whistle and sing, and couldn't for the candy. I had the finest grandpa in the world, and I was the happiest boy in the world. I wanted to share my happiness with my sisters, but decided not to say anything about ordering the pups. Arriving home, I dumped the sack of candy out on the bed. 6 little hands helped themselves. I was well repaid by the love and adoration I saw in the wide blue eyes of my 3 little sisters. Day after day, I flew to the store. Grandpa would shake his head. Then on a Monday, as I entered the store, I sensed a change in him. He was in high spirits, talking and laughing with half a dozen farmers. Every time I caught his eye, he would smile and wink at me. I thought the farmers would never leave, but finally the store was empty. Grandpa told me the letter had come. The kennels were still there, and they had dogs for sale. He said he had made the mail buggy wait while he made out the order. And another thing, the dog market had gone downhill. The price of dogs had dropped $5. He handed me a $10 bill.
Now, there's still one stump in the way, he said. The mail buggy can't carry things like dogs, so they'll come as far as the depot at Tahlequah. But you'll get the notice here because I ordered them in your name.
I thanked my grandfather with all my heart and asked him how long I'd have to wait for the notice. He said,
I don't know, but shouldn't take more than a couple of weeks.
I asked how I was going to get my dogs out from Tahlequah.
Well, there's always someone going in, he said, and you can ride in with them.
That evening the silence of our supper was interrupted when I asked my father this question. Papa, how far is it to Kentucky?
I may as well have exploded a bomb. For an instant there was complete silence, and then my oldest sister giggled. The two little ones stared at me. With a half-hearted laugh, my father said,
Well, now, I don't know, but it's pretty good ways. What do you want to know for, thinking of taking a trip to Kentucky?
No, I said. I just wondered.
My youngest sister giggled and asked,
Can I go with you?
I glared at her.
Mama broke into the conversation.
I declare, what kind of a question is that? How far is it to Kentucky?
I don't know what's gotten into that mind of yours lately. You go around like you were lost, and you're losing weight. You're as skinny as a rail. And look at that hair. Just last Sunday they had a haircutting over at Tom Rowland's place. But you couldn't go. You had to go prowling around the river in the woods.
I told Mama that I'd get a haircut next time they had a cutting, and I'd just heard some fellas talking about Kentucky up at the store and wondered how far away it was. Much to my relief, the conversation was ended. The days dragged by. A week passed, and still no word about my dogs. Terrible thoughts ran through my mind. Maybe my dogs were lost. The train had a wreck. Someone stole my money. Or perhaps the mailman lost my order. Then at the end of the second week, the notice came. My grandfather told me that he had talked to Jim Hodges that day. He was going into town in about a week, and I could ride in with him to pick up my dogs. Again, I thanked my grandfather. I started for home. Walking along in deep thought, I decided it was time to tell my father the whole story. I fully intended to tell him that evening. I tried several times, but somehow I couldn't. I wasn't scared of him, for he never whipped me. He was always kind and gentle. But for some reason, I don't know why, I just couldn't tell him. That night, snuggled deep in the soft folds of a feather bed, I lay thinking. I had waited so long for my dogs, and I so desperately wanted to see them and hold them. I didn't want to wait a whole week. In a flash, I made up my mind. Very quietly, I got up and put on my clothes. I sneaked into the kitchen and got one of Mama's precious flour sacks. In it, I put 6 eggs, some leftover cornbread, a little salt, and a few matches. Next, I went to the smokehouse and cut off a piece of salt pork. I stopped at the barn and picked up a gunny sack. I put the flour sack inside the gunny sack. This I rolled up and crammed lengthwise in the bib of my overalls. I was on my way. I was going after my dogs. Tahlequah was a small country town with a population of about 800. By the road, it was 32 miles away. But as the crow flies, it was only 20 miles. I went as the crow flies, straight through the hills. Although I had never been to town in my life, I knew what direction to take. Tahlequah and the railroad lay on the other side of the river from our place. I had the Frisco Railroad on my right and the Illinois River on my left. Not far from where the railroad crossed the river lay the town of Tahlequah. I knew if I bore to the right, I would find the railroad, and if I bore to the left, I had the river to guide me. Sometime that night, I crossed the river on a riffle somewhere in the Dripping Springs country. Coming out of the river bottoms, I scattered up a long hogback ridge and broke out on top in the flats. In a mile-eating trot, I moved along. I had the wind of a deer, the muscles of a country boy, a heart full of dog love, and a strong determination. I wasn't scared of the darkness or the mountains, for I was raised in those mountains. On and on, mile after mile, I moved along. I saw faint gray streaks appear in the east. I knew daylight was close. My bare feet were getting sore from the flint rocks and the saw briars. I stopped beside a mountain stream, soaked my feet in the cool water, rested for a spell, and then started on. After leaving the mountain stream, my pace was much slower. The muscles of my legs were getting stiff. Feeling the pangs of hunger gnawing at my stomach, I decided I would stop and eat at the next stream I found. Then I remembered I had forgotten to include a can in which to boil my eggs. I stopped and built a small fire.
Cutting off a nice thick slab of salt pork, I roasted it, and with a piece of cold cornbread made a sandwich. Putting out my fire, I was on my way again. I ate as I trotted along. I felfelt much better. I came into Tahlequah from the northeast. At the outskirts of town, I hid my flour sack and provisions, keeping the gunny sack. I walked into town. I was scared of Tahlequah and the people. I had never seen such a big town and so many people. There was store after store, some of them two stories high. The wagon yard had wagons on top of wagons, teams, buggies, and horses. Two young ladies about my age stopped, stared at me, and then giggled. My blood boiled, but I could understand. After all, I had three sisters. They couldn't help it because they were woman folks. I went on. I saw a big man coming up the street. The bright, shiny star on his vest looked as big as a bucket. I saw the long black gun at his side, and I froze in my tracks. I'd heard of sheriffs and marshals, but had never seen one. Stories repeated about them in the mountains told how fast they were with a gun and how many men they had killed. The closer he came, the more frightened I got. I knew it was the end for me. I could just see him aiming his big black gun and shooting me between the eyes. It seemed like a miracle that he passed by, hardly glancing at me. Breathing a sigh, I walked on, seeing the wonders of the world. Passing a large store window, I stopped and stared. There in the window was the most wonderful sight I had ever seen. Everything under the sun. Overalls, jackets, bolts of beautiful cloth, new harnesses, collars, bridles. And then my eyes did pop open. There were several guns, and one of them had two barrels. I couldn't believe it. Two barrels. I'd seen several guns, but never one with two barrels. Then I saw something else. The sun was just right, and the plate glass was a perfect mirror. I saw the full reflection of myself for the first time in my life. I could see that I did look a little odd. My straw-colored hair was long and shaggy and was bushed out like a corn tassel that had been hit by a wind. I tried to smooth it down with my hands. This helped some, but not much. What it needed was a good combing, and I had no comb. My overalls were patched and faded, but they were clean. My shirt had pulled out. I tucked it back in. I took one look at my bare feet and winced. They were as brown as dead sycamore leaves. The spiderweb pattern of raw red scratches looked odd in the saddle-brown skin. I thought, well, I won't have to pick any more blackberries, and the scratches will soon go away. I pumped up one of my arms and thought surely the muscle was going to pop right through my thin blue shirt. I stuck out my tongue. It was as red as pokeberry juice, and anything that color was supposed to be healthy. After making a few faces at myself, I put my thumbs in my ears and was making mule ears when two old women came by. They stopped and stared at me. I stared back. As they turned to go on their way, I heard one of them say something to the other. The words were hard to catch, but I did hear one word, wild. As I said before, they couldn't help it. They were women folks. As I turned to leave, my eyes again fell on the overalls and the bolts of cloth. I thought of my mother, father, and sisters. Here was an opportunity to make amends for leaving home without telling anyone. I entered the store. I bought a pair of overalls for Papa. After telling the storekeeper how big my mother and sisters were, I bought several yards of cloth. I also bought a large sack of candy. Glancing down at my bare feet, the storekeeper said, "I have some good shoes." I told him I didn't need any shoes. He asked if that would be all. I nodded. He added up the bill. I handed him my $10. He gave me my change. After wrapping up the bundles, he helped me put them in my sack. Lifting it to my shoulder, I turned and left the store. Out on the street, I picked out a friendly-looking old man and asked him where the depot was. He told me to go down to the last street and turn right, go as far as I could, and I couldn't miss it. I thanked him and started on my way. Leaving the main part of town, I started up a long street through the residential section. I had never seen so many beautiful houses, and they were all different colors. The lawns were neat and clean and looked like green carpets. I saw a man pushing some kind of a mowing machine. I stopped to watch the whirling blades. He gawked at me. I hurried on. I heard a lot of shouting and laughing ahead of me. Not wanting to miss anything, I walked a little faster. I saw what was making the noise. More kids than I had ever seen were playing around a big red brick building. I thought some rich man lived there and was giving a party for his children. Walking up to the edge of the playground, I stopped to watch. The boys and girls were about my age and were as thick as flies around a sorghum mill. They were milling, running, and jumping. Teeter-totters and swings were loaded down with them. Everyone was laughing and having a big time. Over against the building, a large blue pipe ran up on an angle from the ground. A few feet from the top, there was a bend in it. The pipe seemed to go into the building. Boys were crawling into its dark mouth. I counted 9 of them. One boy stood about 6 feet from the opening with a stick in his hand. Staring goggle-eyed, trying to figure out what they were doing, I got a surprise. Out of the hollow pipe spurted a boy. He sailed through the air and lit on his feet. The boy with the stick marked the ground where he landed. All 9 of them came shooting out, one behind the other. As each boy landed, a new mark was scratched. They ganged around looking at the lines. There was a lot of loud talking, pointing, and arguing. Then all lines were erased and a new scorekeeper was picked out. The others crawled back into the pipe. I figured out how the game was played. After climbing to the top of the slide, the boys turned around and sat down. One at a time, they came flying down and out, feet first. The one that shot out the furthest was the winner. I thought how wonderful it would be if I could slide down just one time. One boy, spying me standing on the corner, came over. Looking me up and down, he asked, "Do you go to school here?" I said, "School?" He said, "Sure, school. What'd you think it was?" "Oh, no, I don't go to school here." "Do you go to Jefferson?" "No, I don't go there either." "Don't you go to school at all?" "Sure I go to school." "Where?" "At home." "You go to school at home?" I nodded. "What grade are you in?" I said I wasn't in any grade. Puzzled, he said, "You go to school at home and don't know what grade you're in? Who teaches you?" "My mother." "What does she teach you?" I said, "Reading, writing, and arithmetic, and I bet I'm just as good at it as you are." He asked, "Don't you have any shoes?" I said, "Sure I have shoes." "Why aren't you wearing them?" "Well, I don't wear shoes until it gets cold." He laughed and asked where I lived. I said, "Back in the hills." He said, "Oh, you're a hillbilly." He ran back to the mob. I saw him pointing at me and talking to several boys. They started my way, yelling, "Hillbilly, hillbilly." Just before they reached me, a bell started ringing. Turning, they ran to the front of the building, lined up in 2 long lines, and marching like little tin soldiers, disappeared inside the school. The playground was silent. I was all alone and felt lonely and sad. I heard a noise on my right. I didn't have to turn around to recognize what it was. Someone was using a hoe. I'd know that sound if I heard it on a dark night. It was a little old white-headed woman working in a flower bed. Looking again at the long blue pipe, I thought, there's no one around. Maybe I can have one slide anyway. I eased over and looked up into the dark hollow. It looked scary, but I thought of all the other boys I had seen crawl into it. I could see the last mark on the ground and thought, I bet I can beat that. Laying my sack down, I started climbing up. The farther I went, the darker and more scary it got. Just as I reached the top, my feet slipped. Down I sailed. All the way down, I tried to grab onto something, but there was nothing to grab. I'm sure some great champions had slid out of that pipe, and no doubt more than one world record had been broken. But if someone had been there when I came out, I know the record I set would stand today in all its glory. I came out just like I went in, feet first and belly down. My legs were spread out like a bean shooter stalk. Arms flailing the air, I zoomed out and up. I seemed to hang suspended in air at the peak of my climb. I could see the hard-packed ground far below. As I started down, I shut my eyes tight and gritted my teeth. This didn't seem to help. With a splattering sound, I landed. I felt the air whoosh out between my teeth. I tried to scream, but had no wind left to make a sound. After bouncing a couple of times, I finally settled down to earth. I lay spread-eagled for a few seconds, and then slowly got to my knees. Hearing loud laughter, I looked around. It was a little old lady with a hoe in her hand. She hollered and asked how I liked it. Without answering, I grabbed up my gunny sack and left. Far up the street, I looked back. The little old lady was sitting down, rocking with laughter. I couldn't understand these town people. If they weren't staring at a fella, they were laughing at him. On arriving at the depot, my nerve failed me. I was afraid to go in. I didn't know what I was scared of, but I was scared. Before going around to the front, I peeked in a window. The station master was in his office looking at some papers. He was wearing a funny little cap that had no top in it. He looked friendly enough, but I still couldn't muster up enough courage to go in. I cocked my ear to see if I could hear puppies crying, but could hear nothing. A bird started chirping. It was a yellow canary in a cage. The station master walked over and gave it some water. I thought, anyone that is kind to birds surely wouldn't be mean to a boy. With my courage built up, I walked around to the front and eased myself past the office. He glanced at me and turned back to the papers. I walked clear around the depot and again walked slowly past the office. Glancing from the corner of my eye, I saw the station master looking at me and smiling. He opened the door and came out on the platform. I stopped and leaned against the building. Yawning and stretching his arms, he said,
"It sure is hot today. Doesn't look like it's ever going to rain."
I looked up at the sky and said, "Yes, sir, it is hot, and we sure could do with a good rain. We need one bad up where I come from." He asked me where I lived. I told him, "Up the river ways."
"You know," he said, "I have some puppies in there for a boy that lives up on the river. His name is Billy Coleman. I know his dad, but never have seen the boy. I figured he would be in after them today."
On hearing this remark, my heart jumped clear up in my throat. I thought surely it was going to hop right out on the depot platform. I looked up and tried to tell him who I was, but something went wrong. When the words finally came out, they sounded like the squeaky old pulley on our well when Mama drew up a bucket of water. I could see a twinkle in the station master's eyes. He came over and laid his hand on my shoulder. In a friendly voice, he said,
"So you're Billy Coleman. How's your dad?"
I told him Papa was fine and handed him the slip my grandpa had given me.
"They sure are fine-looking pups," he said. "You'll have to go around to the freight door."
I'm sure my feet never touched the ground as I flew around the building. He unlocked the door, and I stepped in looking for my dogs. I couldn't see anything but boxes, barrels, old trunks, and some rolls of barbed wire. The kindly station master walked over to one of the boxes.
"Do you want box and all?"
he asked. I told him I didn't want the box. All I wanted was the dogs.
"Well, how are you going to carry them?" he asked. "I think they're a little too young to follow."
I held out my gunny sack. He looked at me and looked at the sack. Chuckling, he said,
"Well, I guess dogs can be carried that way, same as anything else, but we'll have to cut a couple of holes to stick their heads through so that they won't smother."
Getting a claw hammer, he started tearing off the top of the box. As nails gave way and boards splintered, I heard several puppy whimpers. I didn't walk over, I just stood and waited. After what seemed like hours, the box was open. He reached in, lifted the pups out, and set them down on the floor.
"Well, there they are," he said. "What do you think of them?"
I didn't answer. I couldn't. All I could do was stare at them. They seemed to be blinded by the light and kept blinking their eyes. One sat down on his little rear and started crying. The other one was waddling around and whimpering. I wanted so much to step over and pick them up. Several times I tried to move my feet, but they seemed to be nailed to the floor. I knew the pups were mine, all mine, yet I couldn't move. My heart started acting like a drunk grasshopper. I tried to swallow and couldn't. My Adam's apple wouldn't work. One pup started my way. I held my breath. On he came until I felt a scratchy little foot on mine. The other pup followed. A warm puppy tongue caressed my sore foot. I heard the station master say, "They already know you." I knelt down and gathered them in my arms. I buried my face between their wriggling bodies and cried. The station master, sensing something more than just two dogs and a boy, waited in silence. Rising with the two pups held close to my chest, I asked if I owed anything. He said,
"There is a small feed bill, but I'll take care of it. It's not much anyway."
Taking his knife, he cut two slits in the sack. He put the pups in it and worked their heads through the holes. As he handed the sack to me, he said,
"Well, there you are. Goodbye, and good hunting."
Walking down the street toward town, I thought, now maybe the people won't stare at me when they see what I've got. After all, not every boy owns two good hounds. Turning the corner onto the main street, I threw out my chest. I hadn't gone far before I realized that the reception I got wasn't what I thought it would be. People began to stop and stare. Some even snickered. I couldn't understand why they were staring. Surely it couldn't be at the two beautiful hound pups sticking out of the gunny sack. Thinking that maybe I had a hole in the seat of my britches, I looked over to my reflection in a plate glass window. I craned my neck for a better view of my rear. I could see a patch there all right and a few threadbare spots, but no whiteness was showing through. I figured that the people were just jealous because they didn't have two good hounds. I saw a drunk coming. He was staggering all over the street. Just as he was passing me, I heard him stop. As I looked back, I saw he was staring wide-eyed at my sack. Closing his eyes, he rubbed them with his hands. Opening them again, he stared. Shaking his head, he staggered on down the street. All around, people began to roar with laughter. Someone shouted, "What's the matter, John? You seeing things today?" I hurried on, wanting to get away from the stares and the snickers. It wouldn't have happened again in 100 years, but there they came. The same two old women I had met before. We stopped and had another glaring fight. One said, "I declare." The other one snorted, "Well, I never." My face burned. I couldn't take any more. After all, a man can stand so much and no more. In a loud voice, I said, "You may have these people fooled with those expensive-looking feathers in your hats, but I know what they are. They're goose feathers painted with iodine." One started to say something, but her words were drowned out by the roaring laughter from all around. Gathering up their long skirts, they swished on down the street. All around me, people began to shout questions and laugh. One wanted to know if I had the mother in the sack. Storekeepers stepped out and gawked. I could see the end of the street, but it looked as if it were 100 miles away. My face was as red as a fox's tail. I ducked my head, tightened my grip on the sack, and walked on. I don't know where they came from, but like chickens coming home to roost, they flocked around me. Most of them were about my age. Some were a little bigger, some smaller. They ganged around me, screaming and yelling. They started clapping their hands and chanting, "The dog boy has come to town, the dog boy has come to town." My heart burst. Tears came rolling. The day I had waited for so long had turned black and ugly. The leader of the gang was about my size. He had a dirty, freckled face, and his two front teeth were missing. I suppose he had lost them in a back-alley fight. His shock of yellow sunburned hair bobbed up and down as he skipped and jumped to the rhythm of the dog boy's song. He wore a pair of cowboy boots. They were two sizes too big for him, no doubt handed down by an older brother. He stomped on my right foot. I looked down and saw a drop of blood ooze out from under the broken nail. It hurt like the dickens, but I gritted my teeth and walked on. Freckleface pulled the ear of my little girl pup. I heard her painful cry. That was too much. I hadn't worked 2 long, hard years for my pups to have some freckle-faced punk pull their ears. Swinging the sack from my shoulder, I walked over and set it down in a doorway. As I turned around to face the mob, I doubled up my fist and took a Jack Dempsey stance. Freckle-face said, "So you want to fight?" He came in swinging. I reached way back in Arkansas somewhere. By the time my fist had traveled all the way down to the Cherokee Strip, there was a lot of power behind it. Smack on the end of Freck's nose, it exploded. With a loud grunt, he sat down in the dusty street. Grabbing his nose in both hands, he started rocking and moaning. I saw the blood squeeze out between his fingers. Another one sailed in. He didn't want to fight. He wanted to wrestle. He stuck a finger in my mouth. I ground down. Shaking his hand and yelling like the hoot owls were after him, he ran across the street. Another one bored in. I aimed for his eye, but my aim was a little low. It caught him in the Adam's apple. A sick look came over his face. Bending over, croaking like a bullfrog that had been caught by a water moccasin, he started going around in a circle. But there were too many of them. By sheer weight and numbers, they pulled me down. I managed to twist over on my stomach and buried my face in my arms. I could feel them beating and kicking my body. All at once, the beating stopped. I heard loud cries from the gang. Turning over on my back, I was just in time to see the big marshal plant a number 12 boot in the seat of the last kid.
I just knew I was next. I wondered if he'd kick me while I was down. I lay where I was. He started toward me. I closed my eyes. I felt a hand as big as an anvil clamp on my shoulder. I thought, he's going to stand me up and then knock me down.
He raised me to a sitting position. His deep, friendly voice said, "Are you all right, son?"
I opened my eyes. There was a smile on his wide, rugged face. In a choking voice, I said, "Yes, sir, I'm all right."
He helped me to my feet. His big hands started brushing the dust from my clothes.
"Those kids are pretty tough, son," he said, "but they're really not bad. They'll grow up someday."
"Marshal," I said, "I wouldn't have fought them, but they pulled my pup's ears."
He looked over to my sack. One pup had worked its way almost out through the hole. The other one's head and two little paws were sticking out. Both of them were whimpering. A smile spread all over the big marshal's face.
"So that's what started the fight," he said.
Walking over, he knelt down and started petting the pups.
"They're fine-looking dogs," he said. "Where'd you get them?"
I told him I'd ordered them from Kentucky.
"What'd they cost you?"
he asked. $40, I said.
He asked if my father had bought them for me.
"No," I said, "I bought them myself."
He asked me where I got the money.
"I worked and saved it," I said.
"Takes a long time to save $40, he said.
"Yes," I said. "Took me 2 years.
2 years, he exclaimed.
I saw an outraged look come over the marshal's face. Reaching up, he pushed his hat back. He glanced up and down the street. I heard him mutter, "There's not a one in that bunch with that kind of grit."
Picking up my sack, I said, "Thanks for helping me out. I guess I'd better be heading for home."
He asked where I lived. I said,
"Up the river away."
"Well, you got time for a bottle of pop before you go, haven't you?"
I started to say no, but looking at his big friendly smile, I smiled back and said, "I guess I have." Walking into a general store, the marshal went over to a large red box and pulled back the lid. He asked what kind I wanted. I'd never had a bottle of pop in my life and didn't know what to say. Seeing my hesitation, he said,
"This strawberry looks pretty good."
I said that would be fine. The cool pop felt wonderful to my hot, dry throat. My dark little world had brightened up again. I had my pups and had found a wonderful friend. I knew that the stories I had heard about marshals weren't true. Never again would I be scared when I saw one. Back out on the street, I shook hands with the marshal, saying as I did,
"If you're ever up in my part of the country, come over and see me. You can find our place by asking at my grandfather's store."
"Store?"
he asked.
"Why, the only store upriver is about 30 miles from here."
"Yes," I said, "that's my grandpa's place."
He asked if I was afoot.
"Yes," I said.
"Well, you won't make it tonight," he said, "will you?"
"No," I said, "I intend to camp out somewhere."
I saw he was bothered.
"I'll be all right," I said. "I'm not scared of the mountains."
He looked at me and at my pups. Taking off his hat, he scratched his head. Chuckling deep down in his barrel-like chest, he said,
"Yes, I guess you will be all right. Well, goodbye, and good luck. If you're ever in town again, look me up."
From far down the street, I looked back. The marshal was still standing where I had left him. He waved his hand. I waved back. On the outskirts of town, I stopped and picked up a can and my provisions. I hadn't gone far before I realized that I had undertaken a tough job. The sack became heavier and heavier. For a while, my pups cried and whimpered. They had long since pulled their heads back in the sack. I would peek in at them every once in a while. They were doing all right. Curled up into two little round balls on my bundles, they were fast asleep. Deep in the heart of the Sparrowhawk Mountains, night overtook me. There, in a cave with a stream close by, I put up for the night. Taking my pups and bundles from the gunny sack, I used it to gather leaves to make us a bed. My pups followed me on every trip, whimpering and crying, tumbling and falling over sticks and rocks. After the bed was made, I built a fire. In a can of water from the mountain stream, I boiled 3 eggs. Next, I boiled half of the remaining salt pork. Cutting the meat up in small pieces, I fed it to my pups. Each of us had a piece of candy for dessert. My pups enjoyed the candy. With their needle-sharp teeth, they gnawed and worried with it until it was melted away.
While they were busy playing, I dragged up several large timbers and built a fire which would last for hours. In a short time, the cave grew warm and comfortable from the heat. The leaves were soft and felt good to my tired body and sore feet. As I lay stretched out, my pups crawled all over me. I played with them. They would waddle up to the front of the cave, look at the fire, and come scampering back to roll and play in the soft leaves. I noticed the boy dog was much larger than the girl dog. He was a deeper red in color. His chest was broad and solid. His puppy muscles knotted and rippled under the velvety skin. He was different in every way. He would go closer to the fire. I saw right away he was bold and aggressive. Once he went around the fire and ventured out into the darkness. I waited to see if he would come back. He came wobbling to the mouth of the cave, but hesitated there. He made several attempts to come back, but the flames were leaping higher by the minute. The space between the fire and the wall of the cave was much hotter than when he had ventured out. Whimpering and crying, he kept trying to get around the fire. I said not a word, just watched. Puppy though he was, he did something which brought a smile to my face. Getting as close as he could to the side of the cave, he turned his rear to the fire. Hopping sideways, yipping at every jump, he made it through the heat and sailed into the pile of leaves. He had had enough. Curling up in a ball close to me, he went to sleep. The girl pup was small and timid. Her legs and body were short. Her head was small and delicate. She must have been a runt in the litter. I didn't have to look twice to see that what she lacked in power she made up in brains. She was a much smarter dog than the boy dog, more sure of herself, more cautious. I knew when the trail became tough, she would be the one to unravel it. I knew I had a wonderful combination. In my dogs, I had not only the power, but the brains along with it. I was a tired boy. My legs were stiff and my feet sore and throbbing. My shoulders were red and raw from the weight of the sack. I covered my pups up in the leaves and moved my body as close to them as I could. I knew as night wore on and the fire died down, the chill would come. Tired but happy, I fell asleep. Along in the silent hours of night, I was awakened. I opened my eyes but didn't move. I lay and listened, trying to figure out what it was that had aroused me. At first I thought one of my pups had awakened me by moving and whimpering. I discarded this thought, for I could see that they were both fast asleep. I decided it was my imagination working. My fire had burned down, leaving only a glowing red body of coals. The cave was dark and silent. Chill from the night had crept in. I was on the point of getting up to rebuild my fire when I heard what had awakened me. At first I thought it was a woman screaming. I listened. My heart began to pound. I could feel the strain all over my body as nerves grew tighter and tighter. It came again, closer this time. The high pitch of the scream shattered the silence of the quiet night. The sound seemed to be all around us. It screamed its way into the cave and rang like a blacksmith's anvil against the rock walls. The blood froze in my veins. I was terrified. Although I had never heard one, I knew what it was. It was the scream of a mountain lion. The big cat screamed again. Leaves boiled and stirred where my pups were. In the reflection of the glowing coals, I could see that one was sitting up. It was the boy dog. A leaf had become entangled in the fuzzy hair of a floppy ear. The ear flicked. The leaf dropped. Again the hellish scream rang out over the mountains. Leaves flew as my pup left the bed. I jumped up and tried to call him back. Reaching the mouth of the cave, he stopped. Raising his small red head high in the air, he bawled his challenge to the devil cat. The maul must have scared him as much as it had startled me. He came tearing back. The tiny hairs on his back were standing on end. My father had told me lions were scared of fire. I started throwing on more wood. I was glad I'd dragged up a good supply while making camp. Hearing a noise from the bed, I looked back. The girl pup, hearing the commotion, had gotten up and joined the boy dog. They were sitting side by side with their bodies stiff and rigid, their beady little eyes bored into the darkness beyond the cave. The moist tips of their little black noses wiggled and twisted as if trying to catch a scent. What I saw in my pups gave me courage. My knees quit shaking and my heart stopped pounding. I figured the lion had scented my pups. The more I thought about anything harming them, the madder I got. I was ready to die for my dogs. Every time the big cat screamed, the boy dog would run to the mouth of the cave and bawl back at him. I started whooping and throwing rocks down the mountainside, hoping to scare the lion away. Through the long hours of the night, I kept this up. The lion prowled around us, screaming and growling, first on the right, then on the left, and above and below. In the wee hours of morning, he gave up and left to stalk other parts of the mountains. I'm sure he thought he didn't stand a chance against two vicious hounds and a big hunter. After the terrifying night, the bright morning sun was a welcome sight. I fixed breakfast, and soon we were on our way. I tried to get the pups to follow me so as to lighten my load. They would, for a way, and then, sitting down on their rears, they would cry and whimper. Back in the sack they would go, with their heads sticking out of the holes and their long ears flopping. I moved on. About midday, I entered country I knew. I wasn't far from home. I dropped down out of the mountains into the bottoms, far above the place I had crossed the river on my way to town. Staying on the left of the river, I followed its course past several campgrounds, but didn't stop until I came to the one where I had found the magazine. Here I took the pups out of the sack and sat down in the warm sand. As the afternoon wore on, I sat there deep in thought. I was trying to think what I was going to tell my mother and father. I could think of nothing. Finally, I decided I would just tell them the truth, and with the help of the new overalls, cloth, and candy, I would weather the storm. My pups were having a big time playing. With their little front paws locked around each other, they were growling, rolling, and chewing on one another. They looked so cute, I laughed out loud. While I was watching their romping, the thought came, I haven't named them. I went over the list of names. For him, I tried Red, Bugle, Lead, name after name, as before. For her, I tried Susie, Mabel, Queen, all kinds of girl names. None seemed to fit. Still mumbling names over and over, I glanced up. There, carved in the white bark of a sycamore tree, was a large heart. In the center of the heart were two names, Dan and Anne. The name Dan was a little larger than Anne. It was wide and bold. The scar stood out more. The name Anne was small, neat, and even. I stared, unbelieving, for there were my names. They were perfect. I walked over and picked up my pups. Looking at him, I said, "Your name is Dan. I call you Old Dan." Looking at her, I said, "Your name, little girl, is Anne. I call you Little Anne." It was then I realized it was all too perfect. Here in this fisherman's camp, I had found the magazine and the ad. I looked over at the old sycamore log. There I had asked God to help me get two hound pups. There were the pups, rolling and playing in the warm sand. I thought of the old KC baking powder can and the fishermen, how freely they had given their nickels and dimes. I looked up again to the names carved in the tree. Yes! It was all there like a large puzzle. Piece by piece, each fit perfectly until the puzzle was complete. It could not have happened without the help of an unseen power. I stayed at the campground until dark. I knew I had to go home, but I put it off as long as I could. The crying of the pups telling me they were hungry made up my mind for me. I knew the time had come for me to face my mother and father. I sacked up my dogs and waded the river. As I came out of the bottoms, I could see the lamplight glow from the windows of our home. One of the small yellow squares darkened for an instant. Someone had walked across the floor. I wondered who it was. I heard Daisy, our milk cow, moo. I was thinking so hard of what I would say, it startled me for a second. Reaching the gate to our house, I stopped. I had never thought our home very pretty, but that night it looked different. It looked clean and neat and peaceful, nestled there in the foothills of the Ozarks. Yes, on that night I was proud of our home. My bare feet made no noise as I crossed the porch. With my free hand, I reached and pulled the leather that worked the latch. Slowly the door swung inward. I couldn't see my father or sisters. They were too far to the right of me, but my mother was directly in front of the door, sitting in her old cane-bottom rocker, knitting. She looked up. I saw all the worry and grief leave her eyes. Her head bowed down. The knitting in her hands came up to cover her face. I stepped inside the room. I wanted to run to her and comfort her and tell her how sorry I was for all the worry and grief I had caused her. The booming voice of my father shook me from my trance. He said,
"Well, what have you got there?"
Laughing, he got up from his chair and came over to me. He reached and took the sack from my shoulder.
"When we started looking for you," he said, "I went to the store and your grandpa told me all about it. It wasn't too hard to figure out what you had done, but you should have told us."
I ran to my mother, and dropping to my knees, I buried my face in her lap. As Mama patted my head, I heard her say in a quavering voice,
"Oh, why didn't you tell us? Why?"
I couldn't answer. Between sobs, I heard the squeals of delight from my sisters as they fondled my pups. I heard my father say,
"What's this other stuff you've got?"
Without raising my head from my mother's lap, in a choking voice, I said,
"One is for you, one is for Mama, and the other's for the girls."
I heard the snapping of string and the rattle of paper. The ohs and ahs from my sisters were wonderful to hear. Papa came over to Mama. Laying the cloth on the arm of her chair, he said,
"Well, you've been wanting a new dress. Here's enough cloth to make half a dozen dresses."
Realizing that everything was forgiven, I stood up and dried my eyes. Papa was pleased with his new overalls. My sisters forgot the pups for the candy. The light that was shining from my mother's eyes as she fingered the cheap cotton cloth was something I will never forget. Mama warmed some milk for the pups. They drank until their little tummies were tight and round. As I ate, Papa sat down at the table and started talking man talk to me. He asked,
"How are things in town?"
I told him it was boiling with people. The wagon yard was full of wagons and teams. He asked if I had seen anyone I knew. I told him I hadn't, but the station master had asked about him. He asked me where I had spent the night. I told him about the cave in the Sparrowhawk Mountains. He said that must have been the one called Robber's Cave. My youngest sister piped up,
"Did you stay all night with some robbers?"
My older sister said,
"Silly, that was a long time ago. There aren't any robbers there now."
The other one put her nickel's worth in.
"Weren't you scared?"
"No," I said. "I wasn't scared of staying in the cave. But I heard a mountain lion scream, and it scared me half to death."
"Oh, they won't bother you," Papa said. "You had a fire, didn't you?"
I said, "Yes."
He said, "They'll never bother you unless they are wounded or cornered. But if they are, you had better look out."
Papa asked me how I liked town. I said I didn't like it at all and wouldn't live there even if they gave it to me. With a querying look on his face, he said,
"I'm afraid I don't understand. I thought you always wanted to go to town."
"I did," I said, "but I don't anymore. I don't like the people there, and couldn't understand them."
"What was wrong with them?" he asked.
I told him how they had stared at me and had even laughed and made fun of me. He said,
"Oh, I don't think they were making fun of you, were they?"
"Yes, they were," I said, "and to beat it, all the boys jumped on me and knocked me down in the dirt. If it hadn't been for the marshal, I would have taken a beating." Papa said,
"So you met the marshal. What'd you think of him?"
I told him he was a nice man. He had bought me a bottle of soda pop. At the mention of soda pop, the blue eyes of my sisters opened wide. They started firing questions at me, wanting to know what color it was and what it tasted like. I told him it was strawberry, and it bubbled and tickled when I drank it, and it made me burp. The eager questions of my three little sisters had had an effect on my father and mother. Papa said,
"Billy, I don't want you to feel badly about the people in town. I don't think they were poking fun at you. Anyway, not like you think they were."
"Maybe they weren't," I said, "but I still don't want to ever live in town. It's too crowded, and you couldn't get a breath of fresh air." In a sober voice, my father said,
"Some day, you may have to live in town. Your mother and I don't intend to live in these hills all our lives. It's no place to raise a family. Man's children should have an education. They should get out and see the world and meet people."
"I don't see why we have to move to town to get an education," I said. "Hasn't Mama taught us how to read and write?"
"There's more to an education than just reading and writing," Papa said. "Much more."
I asked him when he thought we'd be moving to town.
"Well, it'll be some time yet," he said. "We don't have the money now, but I'm hoping someday we will."
From the stove where she was heating salt water for my feet, Mama said in a low voice, "I pray every day and night for that day to come." I don't want you children to grow up without an education, not even knowing what a bottle of soda pop is, or ever seeing the inside of a schoolhouse. I don't think I could stand that. I'll just keep praying, and someday the good Lord may answer my prayer. I told my mother I had seen the schoolhouse in town. Again, I had to answer 1,000 questions for my sisters. I told them it was made of red brick and was bigger than Grandpa's store, a lot bigger. There must have been at least 1,000 kids going to school there. I told all about the teeter-totters, the swings made out of log chains, the funny-looking pipe that ran up the side of the building, and how I had climbed up in it and slid out like the other kids. I didn't tell them how I came out. "I think that was a fire escape," Papa said.
"Fire escape?" I said. "Looked like a slide to me."
"Did you notice where it made that bend up at the top?" he asked. I nodded my head. "Well, inside the school, there's a door," he said. "If the school gets on fire, they open the door. The children jump in the pipe and slide out to safety."
"Boy, that's a keen way of getting out of a fire," I said.
"Well, it's getting late," Papa said. "We'll talk about this some other time. We better get to bed, as we have a lot of work to do tomorrow."
My pups were put in the corn crib for the night. I covered them with shucks and kissed them good night.
The next day was a busy one for me.
With the hampering help of my sisters, I made the little doghouse. Papa cut the ends off his check lines and gave them to me for collars. With painstaking care, deep in the tough leather, I scratched the name Old Dan on one and Little Ann on the other. With a nail and a rock, two holes were punched in each end of the straps. I put them around their small necks and laced the ends together with baling wire. That evening, I had a talk with my mother. I told her about praying for the two pups, about the magazine and the plans I had made. I told her how hard I had tried to find names for them, and how strange it was finding them carved in the bark of a sycamore tree. With a smile on her face, she asked, "Do you believe God heard your prayer and helped you?"
"Yes, Mama," I said. "I know he did, and I'll always be thankful."
It seems that the worries and wants of a young boy never cease. Now that I had my pups, another obstacle had cropped up. This one looked absolutely impossible. I had to have a coonskin so I could train them. With my three little traps and a bulldog determination, I set out to trap Mr. Ringtail. For 3 solid weeks, I practically lived on the river. I tried every trick I knew. It was no use. I just couldn't catch the wily old coons. In desperation, I went to my grandfather. He smiled as he listened to my tale of woe.
"Well, we'll have to do something about that," he said. "To train those dogs right, you need that coon hide, that's for sure. Now, you watch the store while I go over to my tool shed. I'll be right back."
After what seemed like an eternity, I saw him coming. He was carrying a brace and bit, that was all. With a mischievous little smile on his face, he said,
"You wouldn't think a fellow could catch a coon with this brace and bit, would you?"
I thought he was kidding me, and it made me feel bad.
"Why, Grandpa," I said, "you couldn't catch a coon in a jillion years with that thing. You just don't have any idea how smart they are."
"Yes, you can," he said. "You bet your boots you can. Why, when I was a boy, I caught coons on top of coons with one of these things."
I saw Grandpa was serious, and I got interested. He laid the brace down on the counter, picked up a small paper sack, and filled it about half full of horseshoe nails.
"Now, you do everything exactly as I tell you," he said, "and you'll catch that coon."
"Yes, sir, Grandpa," I said. "I will. I'll do anything to catch one of them."
"Now, the first thing you'll need is some bright objects," he said. "The best thing is bright, shiny tin. Cut out some little round pieces, a little smaller than this bit. You understand?"
I nodded my head.
"Now," he said, "you go down along the river where there are a lot of coon tracks. Find a good, solid log close by and bore a hole down about 6 inches. Drop one of the bright pieces of tin down in the hole and be sure it's laying right on the bottom."
I was all ears. I didn't want to miss one word my grandfather said. Now and then I would glance at him to see if he was kidding me. In a serious voice, he went on talking.
"Now pay close attention," he said, "because this is the main part of the trap."
With eyes as big as a hoot owl's, I looked and listened. He took 4 of the horseshoe nails from the sack. With the thumb and forefinger of his left hand, he made a small O about the size of the bit, which was an inch and a half in diameter.
"Now, we'll say this is the hole you bored in the log," he said. "About an inch apart, drive these nails in on a slant opposite each other."
Holding one of the nails in his right hand, he showed me the right angle.
"The ends of the nails will enter the hole about halfway between the top and the piece of tin," he continued. "Leave an opening between the sharp points big enough for a coon to get his paw through."
He asked me if I understood. Again, I nodded my head and moved a little closer to him.
"How is that going to catch a coon, Grandpa?" I asked.
"It'll catch him all right," he said, "and it won't fail. You see, a coon is a curious little animal. Anything that is bright and shiny attracts him. He will reach in and pick it up. When his paw closes on the bright object, it balls up, and when he starts to pull it from the hole, the sharp ends of the nails will gouge into his paw, and he's caught."
He looked over at me.
"Well, what do you think of it?" he asked.
I closed my eyes, and in my mind I could see the funnel-like entrance of the hole and the sharp slanting points of the nails. I could see the coon reaching in for the shiny piece of metal. Naturally, his paw would be much larger when closed than it was when he reached in. It would be impossible for it to pass the sharp nails. It was all looking pretty good to me, and I was on the point of saying so when it hit me. Why, all the coon had to do was open his paw, drop the object, and he was free. It all blew up then and there. I just knew my grandfather was playing a joke on me. I stepped back and almost cried as I said, "Grandpa, you're kidding me. That kind of a trap couldn't catch a coon. Why, all he'd have to do is open his paw, drop the piece of tin, and he could pull it from the hole."
Grandpa started roaring with laughter.
This did make me feel bad. With tears in my eyes, I started for the door.
"Wait a minute," Grandpa said. "I'm not kidding you. Oh, I know I like to have my joke same as any man, but I meant every word I said."
I turned around and looked at him. He had stopped laughing, and there was a hurt expression on his face.
"I wasn't laughing at you," he said. "I was laughing more at myself than you. I just wanted to see if you were smart enough to see that there was a way the coon could free himself."
"A fellow wouldn't have to be very smart to see that," I said. Grandpa started talking seriously again.
"You know," he said, "a coon has more than one peculiarity about him. When I was a boy, I had a pet coon. By watching him, I saw and learned a lot of things. He had a den in an old hollow tree in our front yard. I don't know the number of times I'd have to climb that tree and get my mother's scissors, buttons, needles, and thimble from his den. Why, he'd even carry out our knives, forks, and spoons. Anything that was bright and shiny, he took to his den."
Grandpa stopped talking for a few minutes. I could see a faraway look in his eyes. Once again, he was living in those long-ago days. I waited in silence for him to go on with his story.
"One of the most peculiar things about that coon," he said, "was his front feet. Once he wrapped those little paws around something, he would never let go. My mother had an old churn. It was one of those kind with a small hole in the lid for the dasher. When she would get through churning, she would take the dasher out to wash it. That crazy coon would climb up on top of the churn, poke his little front paw through the hole, and get a fistful of butter. The hole was small, and when he closed his paw, he couldn't get it back out. All he had to do was open it, drop the butter, and he would be free. But do you think he would? No, sir. He would carry that churn lid all over the house, squalling and growling. Why, it took everyone in the house to free him. I'd have to wrap him up in a gunny sack or an old coat and pry his claws loose from the butter. Seeing this time after time is what gave me the idea for this trap. Once he reaches in and gets hold of that tin, he's caught because he will never open his paw."
With my confidence restored, it all sounded pretty good to me, and I was anxious to try out this wonderful plan. I thanked him, and taking the brace and nails, I left the store. By the time I reached home, it was too late in the day to start making my traps. That night, I talked the idea over with Papa.
"Yeah, I've heard of coons being caught that way," he said, "but I never paid much attention to it. Your grandfather should know, though.
for he was quite a coon hunter when he was a boy.
From what he told me, I said, it never fails.
Papa asked if I wanted him to help make my traps.
No, I said, I think I can do it myself.
I didn't sleep too well that night. I bored holes, drove nails, and fought coons practically all night. Early the next morning, I went to the trash pile. As I stirred around in the rusty old cans, I thought of another time I had searched for a can. Finally, I found the one I wanted. It was bright and shiny. Everything was going along just fine until Mama caught me cutting out the circles of tin with her scissors. I always swore she could find the biggest switches of any woman in the Ozarks. That time she overdid it. I was almost to the river before the stinging stopped. It wasn't hard to find places for my traps. All along the river, large sycamore logs lay partly submerged in the clear blue water. On one, where I could see the muddy little tracks of the ringtails, I bored a hole, dropped in a piece of tin, and drove my nails. On down the river I went, making my traps. I stopped when I ran out of nails. Altogether, I had 14 traps. That night, Papa asked me how I was making out.
"Oh, all right," I said. "I've got 14 of them made."
He laughed and said, "Well, you can't ever tell. You may catch one." The next morning, I was up with the chickens. I took my pups with me, as I just knew I'd have a big ringtail trapped, and I wanted them to see it. I was a disappointed boy when I peeked out of a canebrake at my last trap and didn't see a coon. All the way home, I tried to figure out what I had done wrong. I went to Papa. He put his thinking cap on and thought the situation over. "Maybe you left too much scent around when you made those traps," he said. "If you did, it'll take a while for it to go away. Now, I wouldn't get too impatient. I'm pretty sure you'll catch one sooner or later." Papa's words perked me up just like air does deflated inner tube. He was right. I had simply left too much scent around my traps. All I had to do was wait until it disappeared, and I'd have my coon hide. Morning after morning, it was the same old disappointment. No coon. When a week had gone by and still no results from my traps, I gave up. What little patience I had was completely gone. I was firmly convinced that coons didn't walk on sycamore logs anymore, and bright, shiny objects had about as much effect on them as a coon hound would. One morning, I didn't get up to run my trap line. I stayed in bed. What was the use? It was just a waste of time. When the family sat down to breakfast, I heard my oldest sister say, "Mama, isn't Billy going to get up for breakfast?"
"Why, is he in his room?" Mama asked. "I didn't know. I thought he was down looking at his traps."
I heard Papa say, "I'll go wake him up." He came to the door and said, "You better get up, Billy. Breakfast is ready."
"I don't want any breakfast," I said. "I'm not hungry."
Papa took one look at me and saw I had a bad case of the ringtail blues. He came over and sat down on the bed. "What's the matter?" he asked. "You having coon trouble?"
"Grandpa lied to me, Papa," I said. "I should have known better. Whoever heard of anyone catching a coon with a brace and a bit and a few horseshoe nails?"
"I wouldn't say that," Papa said. "I don't think your grandpa deliberately lied to you. Besides, I've heard of coons being caught that way."
"Well, I don't think I've done anything wrong," I said. "I've done everything exactly as he said, and I haven't caught one yet."
"I still think it's that scent," Papa said. "You know, someone told me, or I read it somewhere, that it takes about a week for scent to die away. How long has it been since you made those traps?"
"It's been over a week," I said.
"Well, the way I figure, it's about time for you to catch one. Yes, I wouldn't be surprised if you came in with one any day now." After Papa had left the room, I lay thinking of what he had said. Any day now. I got up and hurried into my clothes. As soon as I was finished with breakfast, I called my pups and lit out for the river. The first trap was empty. So was the second one. That old feeling of doubt came over me again. I thought, it's no use, I'll never catch one, and I so need the skin to train my pups. On the way to my third trap, I had to walk through a thick stand of wild cane. It was tough going, and my pups started whimpering. I stopped and picked them up. "We'll be out of this in a few minutes," I said, "and then you'll be all right."
I came plowing out of the matted mass and was right on the trap before I realized it. I was met by a loud squall. I was so surprised I dropped the pups. There he was, my first coon. He was humped up on the sycamore log, growling and showing his teeth. He kept jerking his front paw, which was jammed deep in the hole I had bored. He was trapped by his own curiosity. I couldn't move, and I felt like my wind had been cut off. I kept hearing a noise, but couldn't make out what it was. The movement of the boy pup shook me from my trance. The unidentified sound was his bawling. He was trying to climb up on the log and get to the coon. I yelled at him and darted in to get hold of his collar. On seeing my movement, the coon let out another squall. It scared me half to death. I froze in my tracks and started yelling again at my pup. The girl pup worked around behind the coon and climbed up on the log. I screamed at her. She paid no attention to me. Digging his sharp little claws in the bark, the boy pup made it to the top. He didn't hesitate. Straight down that sycamore log he charged. With teeth bared, the coon waited. When my pup was about 2 feet from him, he made a lunge. The coon just seemed to pull my pup up under his stomach and went to work with tooth and claw. The girl pup saved him. Like a cat in a corn crib, she sneaked in from behind and sank her needle-sharp teeth in the coon's back. It was too much for old Ringy. He turned the boy pup loose, turned around, and slapped her clear off the log. She came running to me, yelping her head off. I grabbed her up in my arms and looked for the boy pup. When the coon had turned him loose, he too had fallen off the log. He was trying to get back to the coon. I darted in and grabbed him by the hind leg. With the pup under each arm and running as fast as I could, I lit out for the house. Coming out of the bottoms into a fresh plowed field, I set my pups down so I could get a little more speed. I started yelling as soon as I came inside of the house. Mama came flying out with my sisters right behind her. Papa was out by the barn harnessing his team. Mama yelled something to him about a snake. He dropped the harness, jumped over the rail fence, and in a long lope started for me. Mama reached me first. She grabbed me and shouted, "Where did it bite you?" "Bite me?" I said. "Why, Mama, I'm not bit. I've got him. Mama, I've got him." "Got what?" Mama asked. "A big coon," I said. "The biggest one in the river bottoms. He's this big, Mama." I made a circle with my arms as big as a 20-gallon keg. Mama just groaned way down deep and covered her face with her hands. Some big tears squeezed out between her fingers. Almost in a whisper, I heard her say, "Thank God. I thought you were snake-bitten." My sister, seeing Mama crying, puckered up and started bawling. "He needs a whipping," the oldest one said. "That's what he needs, scaring Mama that way." Something busted loose inside me, and I cried a little, too. "I didn't mean to scare Mama," I sniffed. "I just wanted everyone to know I caught a coon." Up until this time, Papa hadn't said a word. He just stood looking on. "Here now," he said. "Let's have none of this crying. He didn't mean to scare anyone." Taking his handkerchief from his pocket, he stepped over to Mama, put his arm around her, and started drying her eyes. Mama poked her head around him and glared at me. "Billy Coleman," she shouted, "if you ever scare me like that again, I'll take a switch and wear you to a frazzle." This hurt my feelings, and I really did get tuned up. "Everyone's mad at me," I said, "and I haven't done anything but catch the biggest coon on the river." Mama came over. "I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to be cross, but you did scare me. I thought a rattlesnake had bitten you."
"Now that that's all settled," Papa said, "we had better go get that coon."
Looking at Mama, he said,
"Why don't you and the girls go with us? I don't think it'll take long."
Mama looked at me, smiled, and turned to the girls. "Would you like to go?" she asked.
Their only answer was a lot of squealing and jumping up and down. On the way, Mama noticed some blood on my shirt. She stopped me and started looking me over.
"Where did that come from?" she asked. "Did that coon bite you?" "No, Mama," I said. "I didn't get close enough for him to bite me." With a worried look on her face, she jerked out my shirt.
"You don't seem to be scratched anywhere," she said. "Maybe this is where it came from," Papa said.
He reached down and picked up my boy pup. His little black nose was split wide open and was bleeding. I saw a relieved look come over Mama's face. Looking at me, she started shaking her head. "I don't know," she said. "I just don't know."
"Did that coon get hold of this pup?"
Papa asked. "He sure did, Papa," I said. "But it wasn't the coon's fault. If it hadn't been for little Ann, he'd have eaten him up." I told how my dogs had tied into the coon.
Papa laughed as he fondled my pup. "This dog is going to be a coon hound," he said, "and I mean a good one." The coon started squalling as soon as we came in sight.
"My goodness," Mama said, "you wouldn't think anything so small would be so vicious."
Papa picked up a club. "Now, everybody stand back out of the way," he said. "This won't take long." My pups were wanting to get to the coon so badly that they were hard to hold. I had to squeeze them up tight to keep them from jumping right out of my arms. My sisters, with eyes as big as blue marbles, got behind Mama and peeked around her. Papa whacked the coon a good one across the head. He let out a loud squall, growled, and showed his teeth. He tried hard to get to Papa, but the trap held him. The girls buried their faces in Mama's dress and started bawling. Mama turned her back on the fight. I heard her say,
"I wish we hadn't come, poor thing."
Papa whacked him again, and it was all over. It was too much for Mama and the girls. They left. I heard the tall cane rattling as they ran for the house. After the coon was killed, I walked over. Papa was trying to get the coon's paw from the trap. He couldn't do it. Taking a pair of pliers from his pocket, he said, "It's a good thing I had these along, or we would have had to cut his foot off." After Papa had pulled the nails, he lifted the coon's paw from the hole. There, clamped firmly in it, was the bright piece of tin. In a low voice, Papa said, "Well, I'll be darned. All he had to do was open it up, and he was free. But he wouldn't do it. Your grandfather was right." A sorrowful look came over Papa's face as he ran his fingers through the soft yellow hair. "Billy," he said, "I want you to take a hammer and pull the nails from every one of those traps. It's summertime now, and their fur isn't any good. Besides, I don't think this is very sportsmanlike. The coon doesn't have a chance. It's all right this time. You needed this one. But from now on, I want you to catch them with your dogs. That way they have a 50-50 chance."
"I will, Papa," I said. "That's what I intended to do."
While we were skinning the coon, Papa asked me when I was going to start training my dogs.
"I don't know," I said. "Do you think they're too young?"
"No, I don't think so," he said. "I've heard that the younger they are, the better it is."
"Well, in that case," I said, "I'll start tomorrow."
With the help of my oldest sister, we started giving my pups their first lessons. She would hold their collars while I made trails with the hide for them to follow. I'd climb trees that leaned out over the river, jump out into the water, swim to the other side, and make trails up and down the bank. With a long pole and wire, I'd drag the hide on top of rail fences, swing it through the air, and let it touch the ground 20 or 30 feet away. I did everything with that hide a coon would do, and probably a lot of things a coon couldn't do. It was a beautiful sight to see my pups work those trails. At first they were awkward and didn't know what to do, but they would never quit trying. Old Dan would get so eager and excited he would overrun a trail. Where it twisted or turned, he would run straight on, bawling up a storm. It didn't take him long to realize that a smart old coon didn't always run in a straight line. Little Ann never overran a trail. She would wiggle and twist, cry and whine, and pretty soon she would figure it out. At first they were afraid of water. I never would admit it even to myself. I always said that they just didn't like to get wet. They would follow the trail to the stream and stop. Sitting down on their rears, they would cry and beg for help. With a pup under each arm, I'd wade out into the stream and set them down in the cool water. 9 times out of 10, one pup would swim one way and the other one would go just the opposite way. I had a time with this part of their training, but my persistence had no bounds. It wasn't long until they loved the water. Old Dan would jump as far out as he could and practically knock the river dry. Little Ann would ease herself in and swim like a muskrat for the opposite shore. I taught my dogs every trick I knew and any new ones I heard about. I taught them how to split up on a riverbank to search for the hidden trail, because it was impossible to tell where a coon would come out of the water. Sometimes he might swim downstream, and other times he might swim upstream. Maybe he would come back to the bank he had just left, or he would cross over to the other side. Perhaps he would stop in the middle of the stream on an old drift. Sometimes he would come out of the water by catching the dangling limbs of a leaning birch and climbing up, never touching the bank. Or he could come out on the same trail he used to go in and backtrack. He would sometimes crawl up under an undermined bank or into an old muskrat den. One of the favorite tricks of a smart old ringtail is the tree barking trick. This he accomplished by running far up on the side of a tree and using his stout legs for leverage, springing 20 or 30 feet away before touching the ground. Dumb hounds trail up to the tree and start bawling treed. I taught my dogs to circle for a good 100 yards to be sure he was still in the tree before bawling. In order to learn more about coon hunting, I'd hang around my grandfather's store and listen to the stories told by the coon hunters. Some of the tales I heard were long and tall, but I believed them all. I could always tell when Grandpa was kidding me by the twinkle in his eyes. He told me how a coon could climb right up the fog and disappear in the stars, and how he could leap on a horse's back and run him over your dogs. I didn't care, for I loved to hear the tall tales. Anything that had a coon hair in it, I believed completely. All through that summer and into the late fall, the training went on. Although I was worn down to a frazzle, I was a happy boy. I figured I was ready for the ringtails. Late one evening, tired and exhausted, I sat down by a big sycamore and called my dogs to me. "It's all over," I said. "There'll be no more lessons. I've worked hard, and I've done my best. From now on, it's all up to you. Hunting season is just a few days away, and I'm going to let you rest, for I want you to be in good shape the night it opens." It was wonderful indeed how I could have heart-to-heart talks with my dogs, and they always seemed to understand. Each question I asked was answered in their own doggish way. Although they couldn't talk in my terms, they had a language of their own that was easy to understand. Sometimes I would see the answer in their eyes, and again it would be in the friendly wagging of their tails. Other times I could hear the answer in a low whine or feel it in the soft caress of a warm, flicking tongue. In some way, they would always answer. The day hunting season opened, I was as nervous as Sammy, our house cat. Part of that seemingly endless day was spent getting things ready for the coming night. I cleaned my lantern and filled it full of oil. With hog lard, I greased my boots until they were as soft as a hummingbird's nest. I was grinding my axe when Papa came around. He smiled as he said, "This is a big night, isn't it?"
"It sure is, Papa," I said, "and I've waited a long time for it."
"Yes, I know," he said. "I've been thinking. There's not too much to do around here during the hunting season. I'm pretty sure I can take care of things, so you just go ahead and hunt all you want to."
"Thanks, Papa," I said. "I guess I'll be out pretty late at night, and I'll probably have to do a lot of sleeping in the daytime."
Papa started frowning. "You know," he said, "your mother doesn't like this hunting of yours very much. She's worried about you being out all by yourself."
"I can't see why Mama has to worry," I said. "Haven't I been roaming the woods ever since I was big enough to walk? And I'm almost 14 now."
"I know," said Papa. "It's all right with me, but women are a little different than men. They worry more. Now, just to be on the safe side, I think it would be a good idea for you to tell us where you'll be hunting. Then, if anything happens, we'll know where to look."
I told him I would, but I didn't think anything was going to happen. After Papa had left, I started thinking. He doesn't even talk to me like I was a boy anymore. He talks to me like I was a man. These wonderful thoughts made me feel just about as big as our old red mule.
I had a good talk with my dogs.
"I've waited almost 3 years for this night," I said, "and it hasn't been easy. I've taught you everything I know, and I want you to do your best."
Little Ann acted like she understood. She whined and saved me a wash job on my face. Old Dan may have, but he didn't act like it. He just lay there in the sunshine, all stretched out and limber as a rag. During supper, Mama asked me where I was going to hunt. "I'm not going far," I said, "just down on the river." I could tell Mama was worried, and it didn't make me feel too good.
"Billy," she said, "I don't approve of this hunting. But it looks like I can't say no, not after all you've been through getting your dogs and all the training."
"Oh, he'll be all right," Papa said. "Besides, he's getting to be a good-sized man now."
"Man?" Mama exclaimed. "Why, he's still just a little boy.
You can't keep him a little boy always, Papa said. He's got to grow up someday.
I know, Mama said, but I don't like it, not at all, and I can't help worrying. Mama, please don't worry about me, I said. I'll be all right. Why, I've been all over these hills, you know that. I know, she said, but that was in the daytime. I never worried too much when it was daylight, but at night, that's different. It'll be dark and anything could happen. There won't be anything happen, I said. I promise I'll be careful.
Mama got up from the table saying, Well,
it's like I said, I can't say no and I can't help worrying. I'll pray every night you're out.
The way Mama had me feeling, I didn't know whether to go hunting or not. Papa must have sensed how I felt. It's dark now, he said, and I understand those coons start stirring pretty early. You had better be going, hadn't you?
While Mama was bundling me up, Papa lit my lantern. He handed it to me, saying,
I'd like to see a big coon skin on the smokehouse wall in the morning.
The whole family followed me out on the porch. There we all got a surprise. My dogs were sitting on the steps waiting for me. I heard Papa laugh.
Why, they know you're going hunting, he said. Know it as well as anything.
Well, I never, said Mama. Do you really think they do? It does look like they do. Why, just look at them.
Little Ann started wiggling and twisting. Old Dan trotted out to the gate, stopped, turned around, and looked at me.
Sure, they know Billy's going hunting, piped the little one, and I know why.
How do you know so much, silly? Asked the oldest one.
Because I told Little Ann, that's why, she said, and she told old Dan. That's how they know.
We all had to laugh at her.
The last thing I heard as I left the house was the voice of my mother. Be careful, Billy, she said, and don't stay out late.
It was a beautiful night, still and frosty. A big, grinning Ozark moon had the countryside bathed in a soft yellow glow. The starlit heaven reminded me of a large blue umbrella outspread and with the handle broken off. Just before I reached the timber, I called my dogs to me.
Now, the trail will be a little different tonight, I whispered. It won't be a hide dragged on the ground. It'll be the real thing. So remember everything I taught you, and I'm depending on you. Just put one up a tree, and I'll do the rest.
I turned them loose, saying, Go get 'em! They streaked for the timber. By the time I had reached the river, every nerve in my body was drawn up as tight as a fiddle string. Big-eyed and with ears open, I walked on, stopping now and then to listen. The way I was slipping along, anyone would have thought I was trying to slip up on a coon myself.
I had never seen a night so peaceful and still. All around me, tall sycamores gleamed like white streamers in the moonlight. A prowling skunk came wobbling up the riverbank. He stopped when he saw me. I smiled at the foxfire glow of his small beady red eyes. He turned and disappeared in the underbrush.
I heard a sharp snap and a feathery rustle in some brush close by. A small rodent started squealing in agony. A nighthawk had found his supper.
Across the river and from far back in the rugged mountains, I heard the baying of a hound. I wondered if it was the same one I had heard from my window on those nights so long ago. Although my eyes were seeing the wonders of the night, my ears were ever alert, listening for the sound of my hounds telling me they had found a trail.
I was expecting one of them to bawl, but when it came, it startled me. The deep tones of old Dan's voice jarred the silence around me. I dropped my axe and almost dropped my lantern. A strange feeling came over me. I took a deep breath and threw back my head to give the call of the hunter. But something went wrong. My throat felt like it had been tied in a knot. I swallowed a couple of times and the knot disappeared. As loud as I could, I whooped, Hoo-wee! Get him, Dan, get him! Little Ann came in. The bell-like tones of her voice made shivers run up and down my spine. I whooped to her, Hoo-wee! Tell it to him, little girl, tell it to him! This was what I had prayed for, worked for, and sweated for. My own little hounds bawling on the trail of a river coon. I don't know why I cried, but I did. While the tears rolled, I whooped again and again. They straightened the trail out and headed downriver. I took off after them as fast as I could run. A mile downstream, the coon pulled his first trick. I could tell by my dogs' voices that they had lost the trail. When I came to them, they were out on an old drift, sniffing around. The coon had pulled a simple trick. He had run out on the drift, leaped into the water, and crossed the river. To an experienced coon hound, the crude trick would have been nothing at all, but my dogs were just big, awkward pups trailing their first live coon. I stood and watched, wondering if they would remember the training I had given them. Now and then I would whoop, urging them on. Old Dan was having a fit. He whined and he bawled. He whimpered and cried. He came to me and reared up, begging for help. "I'm not going to help you," I scolded, "and you're not going to find him out on that drift. If you would just remember some of the training I gave you, you could find the trail. Now go find that coon." He ran back out on the drift and started searching. Little Anne came to me. I could see the pleading in her warm gray eyes. "I'm ashamed of you, little girl," I said. "I thought you had more sense than this. If you let him fool you this easily, you'll never be a coon dog." She whined, turned, and trotted downstream to search again for the lost trail. I couldn't understand. Had all the training I had given them been useless? I knew if I waded the river, they would follow me. Once on the other side, it would be easy for them to find the trail. I didn't want it that way. I wanted them to figure it out by themselves. The more I thought about it, the more disgusted I became. I sat down and buried my face in my arms. Out on the drift, old Dan started whining. It made me angry, and I got up to scold him again. I couldn't understand his actions. He was running along the edge of the drift, whimpering and staring downriver. I looked that way. I could see something swimming for the opposite shore. At first, I thought it was a muskrat. In the middle of the stream, where the moonlight was the brightest, I got a good look. It was Little Anne. With a loud whoop, I told her how proud I was. My little girl had remembered her training. She came out on a gravel bar, shook the water from her body, and disappeared in the thick timber. Minutes later, she let me know she had found the trail. Before the tones of her voice had died away, old Dan plowed into the water. He was so eager to join her, I could hear him whining as he swam. As soon as his feet touched bottom in the shallows, he started bawling and lunging. White sheets of water, knocked high in the moonlight by his churning feet, gleamed like thousands of tiny white stars. He came out of the river onto a sandbar. In his eagerness, his feet slipped in the loose sand, and down he went. He came out of his roll, running and bawling. Ahead of him was a log jam. He sailed over it and disappeared down the riverbank. Seconds later, I heard his deep voice blend with the sharp cries of Little Anne. At that moment, no boy in the world could have been more proud of his dogs than I was. Never again would I doubt them. I was hurrying along looking for a shallow riffle so I could wade across when the voices of my dogs stopped. I waited and listened. They opened again on my side of the stream. The coon had crossed back over. I couldn't help smiling. I knew that never again would a ringtail fool them by swimming the river. The next trick the old fellow pulled was dandy. He climbed a large water oak standing about 10 feet from the river and simply disappeared. I got there in time to see my dogs swimming for the opposite shore. For half an hour they worked that bank. Not finding the trail, they swam back. I stood and watched them. They practically tore the riverbank to pieces looking for the trail. Old Dan knew the coon had climbed the water oak. He went back, reared up on it, and bawled a few times. "There's no use doing that, boy," I said. "I know he climbed it, but he's not there now. Maybe it's like Grandpa said. He just climbed right on out through the top and disappeared in the stars." My dogs didn't know it, but I was pretty well convinced that that was what the coon had done. They wouldn't give up. Once again, they crossed over to the other shore. It was no use. The coon hadn't touched that bank. They came back. Old Dan went up the river and Little Anne worked downstream. An hour and a half later, they gave up and came to me begging for help. I knelt down between their wet bodies. While I scratched and petted them, I let them know that I still loved them. "I'm not mad," I said. "I know you did your best. If that coon can fool both of us, then we're just beat. We'll go someplace else to hunt. He's not the only coon in these bottoms." Just as I picked up my axe and lantern, Little Anne let out a bawl and tore out down the riverbank. Old Dan, with a bewildered look on his face, stood for a moment looking after her. Then, raising his head high in the air, he made my eardrums ring with his deep voice. I could hear the underbrush popping as he ran to join her. I couldn't figure out what had taken place. Surely little Anne had heard or seen something. I could tell by their voices that whatever it was they were after, they were close enough to see it and were probably running by sight. The animal left the bottoms and headed for the mountains. Whatever it was, it must have realized my dogs were crowding it too closely. At the edge of the foothills, it turned and came back toward the river.
I was still trying to figure out what was going on when I realized that on striking the river, the animal had again turned and was coming straight toward me. I set my lantern down and tightened my grip on the axe.
I was standing my ground quite well when visions of bears, lions, and all kinds of other animals started flashing across my mind. I jumped behind a big sycamore and was trying hard to press my body into the tree when a big coon came tearing by. 25 yards behind him came my dogs, running side by side. I saw them clearly when they passed me, bawling every time their feet touched the ground. After seeing that there was nothing to be scared of, once again I was the fearless hunter, screaming and yelling as loud as I could, "Get 'em, boy, get 'em!" I tore out after them. The trails I knew so well were forgotten. I took off straight through the brush. I was tearing my way through some elders when the voices of my dogs stopped. Holding my breath, I stood still and waited. Then it came, the long, drawn-out bawl of the tree bark. My little hounds had done it. They had treed their first coon. When I came to them and saw what they had done, I was speechless. I groaned and closed my eyes. I didn't want to believe it. There were a lot of big sycamores in the bottoms, but the one in which my dogs had treed was the giant of them all. While prowling the woods, I had seen the big tree many times. I had always stopped and admired it. Like a king in his own domain, it towered far above the smaller trees. It had taken me quite a while to find a name suitable for the big sycamore, for a while I had called it the chicken tree. In some ways it had reminded me of a mother hen hovering over her young in a rainstorm. Its huge limbs spread out over the small birch, ash, box elder, and water oak, as if it alone were their protector. Next I named it the giant. That name didn't last long. Mama told us children a story about a big giant that lived in the mountains and ate little children that were lost. Right away, I started looking for another name. One day, while lying in the warm sun, staring at its magnificent beauty, I found the perfect name. From that day on, it was called the Big Tree. I named the bottoms around it the Big Tree Bottoms. Walking around it and using the moon as a light, I started looking for the coon. High up in the top, I saw a hollow in the end of a broken limb. I figured that that was the coon's den. I could climb almost any tree I had ever seen, but I knew I could never climb the big sycamore, and it would take days to chop it down. There had been very little hope from the beginning, but on seeing the hollow, I gave up. "Come on," I said to my dogs. "There's nothing I can do. We'll go someplace else and find another coon." I turned to walk away. My hounds made no move to follow. They started whining. Old Dan reared up, placed his front paws on the trunk, and started bawling. "I know he's there," I said, "but there's nothing I can do. I can't climb it. Why, it's 60 feet up to the first limb, and it would take me a month to cut it down." Again I turned and started on my way. Little Anne came to me. She reared up and started licking my hands. Swallowing the knot in my throat, I said, "I'm sorry, little girl. I want him just as badly as you do, but there's no way I can get him." She ran back to the tree and started digging in the soft ground close to the roots. "Come on now," I said in a gruff voice. "You're both acting silly. You know I'd get the coon for you if I could, but I can't." With a whip-dog look on her face and with her tail between her legs, little Anne came over. She wouldn't even look at me. Old Dan walked slowly around behind the tree and hid himself. He peeped around the big trunk and looked at me. The message I read in his friendly eyes tore at my heart. He seemed to be saying, "You told us to put one in a tree, and you would do the rest." With tears in my eyes, I looked again at the big sycamore. A wave of anger came over me. Gritting my teeth, I said, I don't care how big you are. I'm not going to let my dogs down. I told them if they put a coon in a tree, I would do the rest. And I'm going to. I'm going to cut you down. I don't care if it takes me a whole year. I walked over and sank my axe as deep as I could in the smooth white bark. My dogs threw a fit. Little Ann started turning in circles. I could hear her pleased, whimpering cry. Old Dan bawled and started gnawing on the big tree's trunk. At first it was easy. My axe was sharp and the chips flew. 2 hours later, things were different. My arms felt like two dead grapevines, and my back felt like someone had pulled a plug out of one end of it and drained all the sap out. While taking a breather, I saw I was making more progress than I thought I would. The cut I had started was a foot deep, but I still had a long way to go. Sitting on their rears, my dogs waited and watched. I smiled at the look on their faces. Every time I stopped chopping, they would come over. While little Ann washed the sweat from my face, old Dan would inspect my work. He seemed to be pleased with what he saw, for he always wagged his tail. Along about daylight, I got my second wind, and I really did make the chips fly. This burst of energy cost me dearly. By sunup, I was so stiff I could hardly move. My hands and arms were numb. My back screamed with pain. I could go no further. Sitting down, I leaned back against the big tree and fell asleep. Little Ann woke me up by washing my face. I groaned with the torture of getting to my feet. Every muscle in my body seemed to be tied in a knot. I was thinking of going down to the river to wash my face in the cool water when I heard a loud whoop. I recognized my father's voice. I whooped to let him know where I was. Papa was riding on Red Mule. After he rode up, he just sat there and looked me over. He glanced at my dogs and at the big sycamore. I saw the worry leave his face. He straightened his shoulders, pursed his lips, and blew out a little air. He reminded me of someone who had just dropped a heavy load. In a slow, calm voice, he asked, "Are you all right, Billy?"
"Yes, Papa," I said. "Oh, I'm a little tired and sleepy. Otherwise, I'm fine."
He slid from the mule's back and came over. "Your mother's worried," he said. "When you didn't come in, we didn't know what had happened. You should have come home."
I didn't know what to say. I bowed my head and looked at the ground. I was trying hard to choke back the tears when I felt his hand on my shoulder.
"I'm not scolding," he said. "We just thought maybe you had an accident or something."
I looked up and saw a smile on his face. He turned and looked again at the tree.
"Say," he said, "this is the sycamore you call a big tree, isn't it?"
I nodded my head.
"Is there a coon in it?"
he asked. "There sure is, Papa," I said. "He's in that hollow limb. See? That one? Way up there? That's why I couldn't come home. I was afraid he'd get away."
"Maybe you just think he's there," Papa said. "I believe I'd make sure before I'd cut down a tree that big."
"Oh, he's there, all right," I said. "My dogs went 10 feet behind him when he went up it."
"Why are you so determined to get this coon?" Papa asked. "Couldn't you go somewhere else and tree one? Maybe the tree would be a smaller one."
"I thought about that, Papa," I said. "But I made a bargain with my dogs. I told them that if they would put one in a tree, I'd do the rest. Well, they fulfilled their part of the bargain. Now it's up to me to do my part. And I'm going to, Papa. I'm going to cut it down. I don't care if it takes me a year."
Papa laughed and said, "Oh, I don't think it'll take that long, but it will take a while. I'll tell you what I'll do. You take the mule and go get some breakfast. I'll chop on it until you get back."
"No, Papa," I said. "I don't want any help. I want to cut it down all by myself. You see, if someone helps me, I wouldn't feel like I kept my part of the agreement."
An astonished look came over my father's face. "Why, Billy," he said, "you can't stay down here without anything to eat and no sleep. Besides, it'll take at least 2 days to cut that tree down, and that's hard work."
"Please, Papa," I begged, "don't make me quit. I just have to get that coon. If I don't, my dogs won't ever believe in me again."
Papa didn't know what to tell me. He scratched his head, looked over to my dogs and back at me. He started walking around. I waited for him to make up his mind. He finally reached a decision.
"Well, all right," he said. "If that's the way you want it, I'm for it, even if it is only an agreement between you and your dogs. If a man's word isn't any good, he's no good himself. Now, I have to get back and tell your mother that you're all right. It's a cinch that you can't do that kind of work on an empty stomach, so I'll send your oldest sister down with a lunch bucket."
With tears in my eyes, I said, "Tell Mama I'm sorry for not coming home last night."
"Don't you worry about your mother," he said, as he climbed on the mule's back. "I'll take care of her. Another thing, I have to make a trip to the store today, and I'll talk this over with your grandfather. He may be able to help some way."
After Papa left, things were a little different. The tree didn't look as big, and my axe wasn't as heavy. I even managed to sing a little as I chopped away. When my sister came with a lunch bucket, I could have kissed her, but I didn't. She took one look at the big tree, and her blue eyes got as big as a guinea's egg.
"You're crazy," she gasped. "Absolutely crazy. Why, it'll take a month to cut that tree down, and all for an old coon."
I was so busy with the fresh side pork, fried eggs, and hot biscuits, I didn't pay much attention to her. After all, she was a girl, and girls don't think like boys do. She raved on.
"You can't possibly cut it down today. And what are you going to do when it gets dark?" "I'm going to keep right on chopping," I said. "I stayed with it last night, didn't I? Well, I'll stay till it's cut down. I don't care how long it takes."
My sister got upset. She looked at me, threw back her small head, and looked up at the top of the big sycamore.
"You're as crazy as a bedbug," she said. "Well, I never heard of such a thing."
She stepped over in front of me and very seriously asked if she could look in my eyes.
"Look in my eyes," I said. "What do you want to do that for? I'm not sick." "Yes, you are, Billy," she said. "Very sick. Mama said when old man Johnson went crazy, his eyes turned green. I want to see if yours have."
This was too much. "If you don't get out of here," I shouted, "you're going to be red instead of green, and I mean that." I grabbed up a stick and started toward her. Of course, I wouldn't have hit her for anything.
This scared her, and she started for the house. I heard her saying something about an old coon as she disappeared in the underbrush. Down in the bottom of my lunch bucket, I found a neat little package of scraps for my dogs. While they were eating, I walked down to a spring and filled the bucket with cool water.
The food did wonders for me. My strength came back. I spit on my hands, and whistling a coon hunter's tune, I started making the chips fly. The cut grew so big I could have laid down in it. I moved over to another side and started a new one. Once, while I was taking a rest, old Dan came over to inspect my work. He hopped up in the cut and sniffed around.
"You had better get out of there," I said. "If that tree takes a notion to fall, it'll mash you flatter than a tadpole's tail."
With a no-care look on his friendly face, he gave me a hurry-up signal with a wag of his tail. Little Anne had dug a bed in a pile of dead leaves. She looked as if she were asleep, but I knew she wasn't. Every time I stopped swinging the axe, she would raise her head and look at me.